Good morning, everyone. I'll call this meeting to order November 1st, 2017 at 9:07. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State, is required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. But before we get on with our official business, I just want to express my gratitude for the folks of Lufkin who have so graciously welcomed us here for this meeting. Personally, I love getting out of Austin and getting around the state to see what's on other people's minds and hear their comments and concerns. We had a wonderful afternoon yesterday at Boggy Slough. It was my first visit, and it was fascinating. I know everybody's proud of it. I will add one more comment. On the way up here, I had a former commissioner call me about another matter, and when he found out I was going to Lufkin, he said, I'll give you an interesting statistic. When he was on the commission, the highest per capita sale of hunting and fishing licenses was in Lufkin. But I did fact check it with Carter, and Carter said, you're like number two now. But that's, that shows you how important hunting and fishing is to this community and to East Texas in general. So we're glad to be here, and thanks for your hospitality.
Corpus.
The next order of business is the approval of the minutes from the previous work session held August 23rd, 2017, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Commissioner Jones, seconded by Commissioner Lee. Thank you very much. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Next order of business is the approval of the minutes of the previous annual public hearing held August 23rd, 2017, which has also been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Thank you very much. Who seconded? Oh, thank you. Commissioner Latimer. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Now we'll move on to work session item number one, update on TPWD progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resource Conservation Recreational Plan. Mr. Carter Smith, please make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and thanks for the opportunity to share a few words with you this morning. I've actually got two presentations. First, Chairman, I'll talk a little bit about some updates inside the department consistent with the land and water plan. And really, just as a point of departure, I want to call the Commission's attention to two reports that we've provided. The first is the annual internal affairs report that's been completed and prepared by Major John Gray. It provides a very comprehensive encapsulation of the work of that team over the last year, the cases that came in that were investigated, the types, the divisions that they related to, also the dispensation of those cases. John and his team continue to do a fabulous job in this regard, and ask you to just take a quick look at that report and familiarize yourself with it. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to contact me or Major Gray. I also want to call your attention to another report, which is also a really great summary of some of the critically important work that our fisheries and wildlife biologists are doing all over Texas. Obviously, they're involved in a wide range of stewardship and habitat management and outreach and technical assistance and conservation-related work, science and monitoring, and so forth. One of our long bits of history inside the agency has been the work of our fisheries and wildlife biologists to help stock fish and game, but also non-game in parts of the state in which we have suitable habitat. And so we've got a report for y'all, an annual stocking report that summarizes those activities from our wildlife and inland fisheries and coastal fisheries divisions. Share some of the details of important work they're doing, like helping to bring back the eastern turkey to the woods of East Texas that we're particularly excited about, helping to restore pronghorn antelope to the desert grasslands of Marfa and Marathon, putting bighorn sheep back on suitable mountain ranges in West Texas. It also describes the really important work that our inland and coastal fisheries hatcheries teams do to help on an annual basis produce over 40 million fingerlings, everything from redfish and trout and now flounder, a really exciting innovation on our coastal fisheries team that's going on there at Sea Center, to bass and catfish and so forth on our inland lakes and reservoirs. So take a look at that report. Again, it's a snapshot of some of the important work that our fisheries and wildlife biologists are doing around the state that really make a difference for the fish and game that our sportsmen and landowners and outdoor enthusiasts in the state care so passionately about, and it's just a terrific summary of that. I also just need to call your attention to Senate Bill 1289 that was sponsored by Senator Creighton in the session, signed into law by Governor Abbott, and essentially it requires any and all state agencies that are involved in any kind of construction project, that if iron and steel is going to be used as part of that contract, it requires us to notify the bidders that they're going to have to source that iron and steel from an American manufacturer. And the bill requires that the commission pass rules to that effect. And so, I simply wanted to notify you of that legislation. We'll be coming back in January for approval, and today we're simply seeking permission to publish rules as required by SB 1289 to promote compliance with the requirement that bid documents for projects in which iron or steel products will be used include a requirement that such iron or steel products be manufactured in the United States. So the department really has no choice in this matter. Like all agencies, we simply need to comply with this legislation. But we'll bring a more formal package for your approval again in January. Chairman Morgan, you mentioned just the very, very rich hunting and fishing heritage and outdoor heritage that exists in this area. Here we are, bow season. Obviously, MLDP season is open. Gun season opens up this Saturday across the state, and we've got a lot of excited hunters. None more so than here in the piney woods of East Texas. We've actually got a deer hunt, I think, at one of our local wildlife management areas that's going on today out at Alazan Bayou, weather permitting. Just in advance of that, though, I did want to provide just a quick summary of kind of where we stand on our important surveillance work and our efforts to contain the spread of chronic wasting disease across the state. Just as a reminder, we have found 63 CWD positive animals in the state. 61 of those are either whitetail or mule deer, and then we found two elk, one in the panhandle, and then one on a game ranch there in Medina County. Essentially, though, we've got three nodes of heightened concern around the state. First, the Waco Mountains just east of El Paso, where we originally found it in the state, likely the source being free-range mule deer that came from New Mexico and wandered across the state lines, and we found a little over a dozen mule deer that are CWD positive since that discovery in 2012, I believe, Mitch. We've also found northwest of Amarillo in the panhandle, one elk and three free-range mule deer. Again, the source of that likely infected animals coming across the state line northwest of Amarillo. And then, of course, one of the areas that's received a lot of attention over the last couple of years have been the four deer breeder facilities up in northern Medina County, in which we have found almost four dozen breeder deer that have tested positive. And, of course, as you will recall, also last year, one free-range whitetail deer in that area. What I think the message I also want to make sure that the commission takes home from this is our wildlife team has been working diligently to make sure that we're doing a very comprehensive assessment of the geographic extent and distribution of the spread of that disease in the state. And obviously with the passage of certain rules and requirements by the commission, everything we can to localize the spread of that. either through department biologists and technicians that have collected and tested animals, private landowners and hunters that have submitted samples voluntarily or as a requirement of being in the containment zone, deer breeders that have submitted samples as part of their testing requirements, or landowners that triple T deer and are also required to test a certain number of deer. We've tested 63,000 samples across the state in the last 2 years, and so that is a very significant effort, and I think is helping to paint, again, a pretty good picture of what we think is going on around the state. There are some new rules this year that the Animal Health Commission has promulgated, and I want to make sure that the commission is aware of that, and this has to do with required testing of CWD-susceptible exotic wildlife on ranches. There are certain requirements that the Animal Health Commission has if you are in a containment zone. But even outside that zone, whether you're a low-fence ranch or a high-fenced ranch, the landowner in those areas in which a hunter or himself or herself harvests a CWD-susceptible exotic, a sika deer, a red deer, an elk, or some kind of a elk hybrid is required to test the first three mortalities off the ranch. And so they're required to test those animals for CWD and then to report those findings back to the Animal Health Commission. So that's an important new requirement that we want to make sure that hunters all across the state are aware of to ensure that they're in full compliance. Obviously, the value of that testing is important to us as we continue to get a handle on any potential carriers or vectors that are out there on the landscape. With all of the discussion that we have had about chronic wasting disease in the state, again, going back well in advance of 2012, but certainly amplified since the discovery, I do think it's fair to note, Chairman, that Texas is not the only state that is engaged in these kind of very important wildlife disease surveillance and monitoring and containment-related efforts. We've got 41 states and 7 provinces across the country that have passed some kind of regulations that prohibit in full or part the movement of hunter-harvested carcasses across state lines. 36 states have some kind of a testing requirement in breeder pen related facilities to ensure that those animals are tested for disease. 26 states have testing requirements in what are called shooting preserve related facilities, high fence facilities in which animals are either released or bred in those facilities ultimately for hunting and harvest related purposes. And then in the news recently, there's been a fair amount of attention for new requirements that have been put in place up in Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin, where additional containment zones, testing requirements, or quarantines were put in place. And a lot of discussion out west in Wyoming, which has largely been considered to take a very passive kind of monitoring approach to the CWD-related issue out there, and very strong push in that state to help revisit their CWD management plan for the state and the actions that they're taking. So, again, this is a challenge that Texas does not shoulder by itself, and our biologists continue to work very actively with their peers across the country so that we're bringing you the most contemporaneous scientific information and management information on what's working, what's new out there on this front, and what we can all do together to try to help limit and localize the spread. And that's important for all of us, no matter where we sit on the continuum of deer management. Over lunch today in executive session, the commission will have a closed-door discussion with our general counsel about some of the litigation that the department has been involved in. There have been two fairly important outcomes in recent court cases. You will undoubtedly recall and know that the department has been sued on two occasions over efforts to challenge the validity and authority of the comprehensive CWD rules that were passed to help govern testing requirements in breeder deer. A case brought against the department by Mr. Peterson and Bailey not only challenged the authority of that, but also asserted that all deer that were possessed by a landowner as part of a deer breeder permit were the property of the landowner and not the state. In that case, they also requested that the state be responsible, and specifically the department, for paying attorney fees in that case. I'm pleased to report from the department perspective that the court has ruled against the plaintiffs on all claims and denied those claims, and also ordered that the plaintiffs pay the department $425,000 in attorney fees. The plaintiffs have, not surprisingly, appealed that decision, and so it will be taken to appeals court. In addition, we were sued by a game ranch and breeder facility in northern Medina County, Record Buck Ranch, who sued the department and the Animal Health Commission, again challenging the authority of both agencies to implement and assert certain controls to prohibit the release of deer from a CWD positive deer breeding related facility. That plaintiff was denied in court a temporary injunction that he had pursued to stop the department and the Animal Health Commission from enforcing those regulations. The landowner has subsequently entered into a herd plan with the Animal Health Commission and the Parks and Wildlife Department, and subsequent to that, I believe we have found two more CWD positives on that property. So if you've got any more questions about those particular cases, commissioners, I would just request that you hold those for executive session, and we talk to counsel about that at that time. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there and see if you or the commissioners have any questions about anything.
I have one question. Is there any progress being made on live CWD testing?
Is any progress being made on live CWD testing? Certainly we continue to allow the tonsil and rectal biopsy tests as part of the testing regimes that are permitted under that program. There's been some announcements about work going on right now to look at potential blood tests to see if that's a way to be able to detect CWD. To my knowledge, and I'm going to look at our team here, those tests have not yet been authorized by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but that a private group that's working on that continues to pursue that. So I think there's a lot of interest in the science of that and seeing if some additional tests can be developed, but right now I'm not sure of any other major new development, but let me look at our team to see if that's correct. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, Carter, thank you.
Carter, just I glanced briefly through the internal investigation report, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm reading it accurately, that in looking at the summary of the various case breakdowns, case types that we had or we reviewed, we had zero cases in discrimination arena and zero in the sexual harassment arena.
That's my understanding that came through internal affairs specifically. Again, this report is specific to internal affairs.
Right, but that's zero for both of those areas.
I'm not sure that that's true across the entire agency, Commissioner, that we may have had some complaints that came in through HR, and I'll be happy to get you some more information on that.
Got it. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, Carter. Work session item number two, Hurricane Harvey update.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, again, for the record, my name is Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. I want to share a few words about the impact of Hurricane Harvey, and I guess just as a point of departure, Chairman and Commissioners, let me just simply acknowledge it first, the huge human toll and economic impact that superstorm has had on a big portion of our state, from Corpus Christi to Beaumont and Houston and inland, 50 or 60 miles, and including on communities like Lufkin and areas around this area that were subsumed with lots of rain and some wind damage from it. Many people in this room suffered damages themselves personally or had their families or friends or colleagues or employees affected. Please know just how sensitive we are to the human cost of this storm. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, before talking a little bit about the various impacts from the storm, including the department's role and the initial response to the storm, talking about impacts to essentially the outdoor-based economy, impacts to department facilities, but also the natural resources that we're charged with protecting. I just want to show a very quick video that our communications team put together that I think paints a very vivid and poignant picture of this storm. And so with that, let's turn on the video. Obviously, our state is going to be recovering from the impacts of this storm for a long time in certain places, and that response and that recovery is going to include the department. Obviously, we had somewhat of the inauspicious distinction of the last commission meeting coming immediately in advance upon the arrival of Hurricane Harvey, and as we all watched that closely and immediately go from what was thought to be a essentially a tropical storm to a Cat 1 to what ultimately was a Category 4 hurricane that made landing that Friday evening around 10 o'clock there at San Jose and ultimately Rockport with 130 mile per hour winds. Interestingly, that storm did exactly what the climatologists and meteorologists at the State Operations Center told us it was going to do, that it was going to come in through that area and then it was going to perch over the state for several days in a very localized, stationary manner and dump copious amounts of rainfall. They used the term record amounts of rainfall on numerous occasions, and unfortunately, in this occasion, the meteorologists were absolutely right. And then the storm did, again, exactly what they predicted it would do, which was go back out to the Gulf and then ultimately come back in and make a second landfall on the upper coast and then go through East Texas and through the Southeast. The impacts on our economies and properties and communities were substantial. These pictures, I think, are important just to help remind us of the struggles that are going on in communities up and down the coast. This is a picture, obviously, of the Rockport community, and you can see the impacts there and the harbors and the marinas there on both recreational and commercial fishing vessels. That's a dry storage barn there in Rockport that had literally hundreds of boats that was sandwiched with the voluminous amounts of wind and so forth that came through there. Again, pictures of typical very catastrophic damage to homes there on the coast. That's a shot of Port Arthur, obviously, that caught upwards of 50 inches of rain in that area and those communities on the upper coast that were submerged with water for a very extended period of time. Suffice to say, the storm was costly and deadly in many, many ways, and I know that all of us in this room will never forget those very pronounced impacts. I would be remiss, however, commissioners, if I did not share with you the department response during the event. Very proud of our team of first responders who worked very closely with local and state and federal officials to provide a helping hand, I think, when our state needed it most. Just by way of background, and as is customary, when a storm is approaching the state, The governor will oftentimes activate the state operations center that's run by the Department of Emergency Management with the governor. Our law enforcement division is the official liaison for the department in that center, where our team works side by side with agencies from across the state and federal government, local entities, as well as nonprofits like the Red Cross. And our team's job is to make sure that we are responding to requests for assets, whether that's boats or helicopters or people or trucks or equipment, or mobilizing people in places. Also to help relay other needs of the department and communities in which our officers and staff are seeing around the state, and obviously playing an important role in briefing the governor and his team on the response and the activities to date. And that's a 24/7 job, and I want to acknowledge and thank Graham Jones and his team, and just the extraordinary service there. They're very, very, very highly regarded there because of their quick and efficient response. One of the things that we also do as an agency that I think is important for the commission to be mindful of is that when some kind of a catastrophic event hits the state and impacts department facilities, we stand up our own incident command center there at headquarters. This one very capably led by Robert Crossman with our State Parks team. And it's a multi-divisional team that interfaces with all of our site managers out in the field to assess what are the damages, what do you need, are people in danger, whether that's visitors at any of our places or employees. Are there power-related problems? Have people lost their homes and we need to find places for them to live? The power supply, water supply. Do you need chainsaw crews to help with clearing fallen trees and so forth? It also helps to provide a comprehensive accumulation of damages to parks and wildlife management areas as offices around the state. And our incident command team, again, staffed by all the divisions, just did a phenomenal job in Harvey, and really appreciate their service. I want to talk a little bit about the search and rescue related efforts, and certainly all of our officers and staff that were involved in these efforts will be quick to say that there were a lot of other people that were involved in these efforts, and there were. And so this is by no means to exclude them by omission, but I want to tell you how deeply proud I am. Our game wardens, not surprisingly, those that are stationed along the coast from Corpus up to Beaumont and inland, were very, very busy working with the local emergency operations center and interfacing with the county emergency operation infrastructure on search and rescue related efforts, in which they just did a phenomenal job. We also ended up deploying another 350 game wardens around the state to help with that, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. They were also very capably joined by roughly 100 of our state park police, who also were responsible not only for the safety of evacuees inside our state parks, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but also going to places like Beaumont and Houston and Village Creek to help with emergency-based response and water-based rescues. You can see here with their battery of boats and airboats and trucks, et cetera, and I really appreciate the work of our state park police, who also play a critically important role as first responders. The efforts weren't limited just to law enforcement. This is a shot of our wildlife division staff, and they played an essential role, particularly in Commissioner Scott. You're certainly aware of this in the Beaumont and Port Arthur area, a place like Bevel Oaks. And our wildlife technicians and their very capable and expert use of airboats were able to get into communities that were under 8, 10, 12 feet of water, made hundreds of water-based rescues, and very proud of our wildlife team on the upper coast at places like Port Arthur and the Murphy area and at Mad Island on the mid-coast, and their contributions to the search and rescue-related efforts. Our inland fisheries team, which also has those important capabilities and expert navigational ability and equipment with shallow draft boats and airboats, also played an important role. Our staff from over in Brooklyn and College Station were involved in everything from body recovery to power line related surveys to welfare checks to, again, emergency related rescues. And I'm proud of our inland fisheries staff that were also involved. Meanwhile, staff from all of our divisions, coastal fisheries, wildlife, state parks, inland fisheries, law enforcement, communication, infrastructure, we're also taking care of families, taking care of folks in their neighborhoods, taking care of other employees that had lost their homes and had them significantly impacted. Our game wardens continue to play a very leading role in the state that's sometimes a bit unsung in terms of the emergency response. And once again, they're the first to be called, and they're the first to come, and they're the last to go. And with the equipment, with the swift water boats and airboats and shallow draft boats, they were able to make a huge difference in communities all up and down the coast. I can't tell you how many compliments that I and many others have received about their efforts, whether that's local game wardens in Corpus Christi or Rockport, or the game wardens that came in from other parts of the state to help Beaumont and Katy, or to help with addressing communities that were flooding as the Colorado River was having its various surges and moving down the river in places like Columbus or in Wharton County. Ultimately, they're responsible for over 12,000 water-based rescues, and I just want you to think about that in terms of the lives of our citizens that depended upon our colleagues to get them to safety. This also provided an opportunity for us to have our inaugural use of our helicopter and our hoist-related system to help rescue citizens that were stranded in floodwaters, and so we were able to deploy our team of rescue swimmers and our helicopter hoist to rescue folks. The very first two people that were brought to safety by the use of that helicopter hoist happened to be two young twins who were in floodwaters with their grandfather, and very proud of the work of our aviation team, Colonel, on that front. Just absolutely remarkable. While all of this is going on, and you know the very consequential impact, and our employees did not leave that unscathed. And so we had colleagues from law enforcement and other divisions that were out doing rescues while, you know, their homes had flooded, in some cases lost altogether. And so I hope we never forget the public service commitment that comes from the men and women that work for you at the department and the very considerable personal sacrifices that they make in these times of great need. They just represent us incredibly well. You saw in the video that we had assistance from 250 game wardens, ultimately from nine states that were part and parcel of the overall state response. And they were phenomenal partners. Game wardens from Louisiana were some of the first to arrive, knowing that that storm was going to be coming back their way. And we had upwards of 60 or 70 game wardens from Louisiana that were deployed. Florida sent over 120 game wardens to come help us in Texas. And again, the very next couple of weeks, they're dealing with their own storm. Game wardens from South Carolina and Arkansas and Indiana and Kansas and Oklahoma and as far away as Pennsylvania and Colorado came to help, and what help they gave. And we're awfully appreciative to our colleagues from other states and their rapid response. As you know, our department has a history with helping other states in their time of need, Katrina being the most obvious example, but certainly during the hurricane in Florida, we sent a contingent of, Colonel, I think, 60 or 70 game wardens there to help us as well. So we're proud of those cross-state efforts. One of the other things that we do when the governor declares a state disaster is that we open up the state park system to people who have lost their homes or can no longer safely be in their home because of some kind of damage or danger. Very proud of our state parks team, Brent, and the over 8,000 people that evacuated from Hurricane Harvey and came to stay for free in state parks. This was a big deal, as you can imagine. And so state parks like Corpus Christi, very close to the communities of Rockport and Tivoli and Austwell that were hit so hard by this storm, that provided approximate place for them to stay for free while they tried to figure out how to get back to their home sites very, very, very safely. And that was obviously a really important part of the state response. The governor mentioned that a number of times, and I know he was appreciative of the department doing that. This is a shot of some of the evacuees on the left there at McKinney Falls, the other one there at Cleburne in the group dining hall. You know, these kind of events, commissioners, as y'all know, there's a fraction of these events in which it brings out the worst of people, but for the most part, it brings out the very best of people. And our friends group and state park staff, like at Cleburne, would put on dinners and provide food for the evacuees and just really put our state and our communities and our department's best foot forward. We've talked a lot about the human-related impact, and obviously it's very close and personal to a number of folks on the dais and in this room as a whole. Clearly, we're also charged with monitoring and managing the response and impacts to natural resources around the state. Obviously, storms are not uncommon to the Texas coast, and most organisms have evolved to adapt to the periodic hurricane that hits our coast. Oftentimes people have an expectation of a big Category 4 storm like this causing catastrophic impacts to fish and wildlife. And we rarely see that. You know, the impacts tend to be more localized in terms of mortality. You know, we saw that in Ike with the huge storm surge and impacts to the alligator population. The floods in the bottomland in which fawns weren't able to get out, and so we lost animals like that. Always going to have some wind-related mortality to birds, and we certainly saw that down on the mid-coast area. But otherwise, most species, really, certainly at a population level, we don't see some kind of an enduring or lasting related impact. And we'll talk a little bit about oysters because certainly there were some impacts there, but most of what we see are things like habitat-related impacts. This is a salt marsh there at the Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area. In this case, it wasn't so much storm surge bringing salt water into the marshes. It was the voluminous amounts of rain and, in some cases, the backwash of fresh water into areas that subsumed areas. This salt marsh was under freshwater submergence for a matter of weeks, and so several thousand acres of marsh that were killed. That obviously has an impact on that particular marsh stand and marsh community and the organisms that that depend upon it. One of the more pronounced impacts that we saw had to do with the Rookery Islands along the coast. There are hundreds of these Rookery Islands, most of which are man-made spoil islands, which provide important habitat for nesting migratory birds, everything from herons and egrets and ibis and pelicans to a wide variety of shorebirds and wading birds. Basically, every rookery island along the coast from the upper coast all the way down to the upper Laguna Madre was completely submerged with water. And so what does that mean? On one hand, it wiped out, you know, feral hogs and coyotes that had made their way over there, and that's a good thing to have those carried off those islands. On the other hand, it also damaged a lot of the vertical structure, and by that I mean the shrubby species that wading birds, the heronries, again, everything from great blue herons to reddish egrets and tricolor herons and great egrets and so forth used to nest. And so that loss of vertical structure on Rookery Islands is very significant. And so one of the things we're doing that Robin has been a big part of helping to work on with National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and Clayton's team is helping to fund work with some of our nonprofit partners to help replant woody structure to help provide some substrate for nesting. Perhaps the even bigger impact, though, was the erosional-related impacts on those barrier islands, and so the loss of shoreline and nesting substrate. And we saw that at Rookery Islands. This is Tern Island, in which, you know, we lost as much as 40 feet of shoreline. That's a shot, I'm sorry, of Sundown Island there in Matagorda Bay, very important Rookery Island there that, you know, lost upwards of 75 to 100 feet of that island. And that's a big issue when we're talking about relatively small islands and impacts. Zigzag Island there in the coastal bend, lost upwards of 75 feet of shoreline. And it's very expensive to come back in and re-nourish or rebuild those sandy-related habitats and get marsh restored and so forth to bring those islands together. We spent a lot of time talking with the commission about oysters over the last couple of years. Probably the last thing that our oyster fishery needed was being subsumed with lots of fresh water. Oysters have a certain tolerance zone of salinity. And anytime the water and the bay waters get down to salinities below 2 parts per thousand for a month at a time with high temperatures, that means problems for oysters, which, as you know, are already under a lot of stress. You can see these oysters right here. You may think they're healthy, but you can see how those shells are open, and that tells you that those are dead oysters, not live oysters. Where we particularly took it on the chin was over in East Bay and Galveston Bay, where we had lost robin, you know, anywhere between 50 to 100% of those oyster reefs in that area west of the Houston Ship Channel, over a 60% mortality. If there was a saving grace with all of that fresh water pouring into Galveston Bay, it was that the middle of the bay still retained a fair amount of salinity. And so we didn't see the oyster-related mortality that we thought we might see. Our leaseholders that lease submerged bottom land in Galveston Bay, as all of you are acutely aware of, reported losses of anywhere from 25% to 100% of their stocks. And, one of the, again, important elements that our coastal fisheries team was doing literally within days after the storm is back out in the bay sampling the fisheries, the oysters, and monitoring the response. Again, very, very impressive. So what were the impacts to the kind of outdoor recreation-related participation and the economy along the coast? And, you know, just as a reminder, upwards of 45% of our recreational licenses that we sell on an annual basis come from counties within the disaster zone. 45%. Harris County alone accounts for about 12 to 13% of those sales. 99% of the commercial landings of seafood occur within that disaster zone. 75% of the recreational saltwater landings occur within that disaster zone. So the impacts, obviously, on outdoor-related participation and certainly our line of work was significant, and probably no surprise to any of you that immediately following the storm, nobody was buying a hunting and fishing license around Labor Day weekend, and that had a big impact when you think about the volume of outdoorsmen from Corpus Christi to Beaumont and then inland to places like LaGrange or Lufkin and Beaumont and so forth. We had considerable amount of damage to all of the recreational-related infrastructure on the mid-coast. Again, you see this statistic, roughly 15% of the boat ramps damaged in some form or fashion. But that doesn't begin to tell the story in terms of the damages to marinas and gas stations and hotels and restaurants and residents where folks at work in the commercial, recreational, fishing, and hunting and outdoor industries related communities reside. Not surprisingly, we had to cancel a number of our public hunts around the state, 11 hunts overall. Clayton, I believe most of those were probably teal hunts and alligator hunts, and these were areas that were submerged with water, and we couldn't get folks in safely. And really, to be fair, in those parts of the state and the coast, folks really weren't thinking about teal hunting or alligator hunting at the time. I think you'll see some statistics probably at some point about alligator harvest numbers being appreciably lower. And again, I think that's just an artifact of hunters really not going out because they were preoccupied with a whole lot more important things. It doesn't suggest that there was some big, large mortality-related event. One of the things that our coastal fisheries team is doing right now with NOAA is assessing damages to commercial fishing-related industries. Again, that part of the coast that was hit, particularly in the mid-coast area from, let's say, Corpus Christi Bay all the way up through Matagorda Bay, was hit pretty hard. You know, every single wholesale commercial fish dealer, bay and bait dealer in that Rockport area sustained some kind of damage, and you know, almost 40% of those dealers still aren't yet back in business. We'll have some better numbers on this, Robin, I assume, in the ensuing months as we work with the commercial fishing industry to pursue some kind of assistance through NOAA and congressional appropriations. But suffice to say, on that mid-coast, it was by no means inconsequential. Parks and Wildlife has a big footprint along the coast. We own and steward a lot of properties. We have employees that live, obviously, in those coastal areas. As you saw from the video, we had ultimately upwards of 100 colleagues who either lost their homes in the storm or had them damaged. I want to thank Pamela Wheeler, our HR director. I saw Pamela here, Ann Bright, the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, our regional leadership division directors worked hard to support those colleagues who lost a lot. We ended up having, and I think the video that you saw suggested that there were 44 facilities that were impacted in some form or fashion, and there were, but really 30 that sustained kind of meaningful damage. 16 state parks, five of our wildlife management areas, 8 coastal fisheries office, and a big regional office in Rockport that was hit hard. Our coastal fisheries office in Dickinson that also took on a fair amount of water. And the damage is what you would expect. On the mid-coast, buildings that were blown down, roofs that were blown off, sides of buildings that were blown off, huge amounts of debris pile, roads that were absolutely ripped up and made, you know, impassable at places like Goose Island or Mustang Island. You move up the coast, we had lots of flooding at places like Stephen F. Austin or Brazos Bend or the J.D. Murphy Wildlife Management area or Mad Island or the Justin Hurst. Shortly after the storm, at the request of the governor, we did some very, what I would call, preliminary assessments of infrastructure damage. We bracketed that at somewhere between $30 and $50 million. I'll stress those are preliminary estimates, and I wouldn't get too hung up on those, but it was not inconsequential. We also, not surprisingly, given that we have, as you know, a big peak of hunting license sales the first couple of weeks before the opening weekend of deer season. We see another peak right before deer season, a gun deer season opening this weekend, and then we see a lesser peak over the holidays. And really by the 1st of January, I'm looking for Mike Jensen, wherever Mike is, you know, we're able to account for really three-quarters of our license-related revenue, and then we're depending upon fishermen to kind of take us through the rest of the year. Not surprisingly, after the storm, you know, we were, you know, right off the bat 20% behind where we were last year with the sale of recreational licenses. We've closed that gap some. We're between 9 and 10% behind where we were last year. I think Mike and all of us still harbor hopes that by January we will have caught up more. That was certainly the trend that we saw in Ike. But at our January commission meeting, I think that will depict a much more accurate picture of where we're likely to stand with respect to our revenue streams, not only on the hunting and fishing licenses, but also our state parks, many of which were closed, some of which are still closed, some were kept open just for evacuees for as long as a month, and so we're behind in that area by upwards of $2 million. Also important to point out that as part of our initial response to this event, the department expended around $13 to $16 million. Those obviously were not budgeted funds, and that'll be something that we hope will all be relatively reimbursable by FEMA. That doesn't happen overnight. And so, again, from a budgetary perspective, I will just want to make sure that the commission is attuned to these kind of economic issues. Now, here's some shots of our facilities, and, you know, they look a lot like people's homes and businesses across the coast. Here are the kind of structural-related damages at some of our state parks, our Matagorda Wildlife Management Area, our Rockport Regional Office. You can see the fairly extensive damage there to those buildings. Again, a shot of a couple of our wildlife management areas, Guadalupe Delta and the Murfree and Mustang Island State Park there. Obviously not a pretty sight. We're not going to be able to salvage those kind of facilities. Erosion is a big and oftentimes overlooked impact, not in this department, but elsewhere. That rain had a huge impact on our roads at places like Mustang Island and Goose Island that washed away critical repairs. And Jessica, out of that damage assessment, we're estimating that $7, $8, $9 million or so of that is road-related damage, and we'll have to work with TxDOT to try to address that. But also you see damage to our levees. These are wildlife biologists and technicians on the wildlife management areas that are responsible for managing these very extensive wetland units. Levees and road systems damaged extensively. You can see that hillside there at the John D. Parker Fish Hatchery, which is just a disaster over there. Again, more examples of that kind of road erosion, levee erosion that we're going to have to come back in and fix to some degree. We talked about the flooding, particularly in a lot of these river and lake-based parks. An auspicious distinction of record floods there at Brazos Bend, where the river crested at almost 53 feet above sea level. Again, shots of other places like Village Creek State Park and the J.D. Murfree Wildlife Management Area. That's the Dickinson Marine Lab. Robin, we have, 40, 45 colleagues that are based there. It is elevated, but it took on water, and we're still struggling with some of that. A shot of our Justin Hurst Wildlife Management Area there along the mid-coast, again, completely underwater. I would be also very remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the immediate response from our staff out in the field, which was just absolutely remarkable. I want you to know that all of our sites have emergency response plans, and so those get activated upon an impending threat of a storm. And, you know, unlike so many other businesses that maybe do things to prepare for a storm, our staff are doing all of that, but they're also responsible, particularly in these coastal communities, of moving huge amounts of heavy equipment and vehicles. So tractors and dozers and skid steers and shredders and trucks and vehicles and lawnmowers, et cetera, inland to safe ground. And the amount of effort when you have a state park or a wildlife management area or fish hatchery with boats and trailers and so forth is huge, and they did a masterful job. They also, all the king's horses and all the queen's men couldn't keep our colleagues from coming back to their sites that they're responsible for managing for the state right after the storm. And so amazing to be on the coast within days of the storm and seeing colleagues who had lost their own homes and had to take care of their families, but were back on site helping to deal with the debris and the flood and the cleanup of just absolutely remarkable. That incident command team that I mentioned at headquarters, responsible also for mobilizing work teams to come from other sites to help, you know, sending chainsaw crews to places like Goliad to help a team of three or four folks that are dealing with, you know, huge amounts of damage there. You know, obviously the question that is undoubtedly on your mind, it has certainly been on mine and the department's mind at the staff level, is how in the world are we going to pay for all this? And, you know, I have to tell you, it doesn't come at a good time. You know, we've got $750 million of deferred maintenance across our facilities and infrastructure, water, wastewater, utility systems that are in very, very bad shape and in some cases at a real tipping point. The interesting converse of that is state park visitation is still off the charts. We've been growing by double digits over the last 4 years. And so, notwithstanding the fact that we have all these damaged parks and closed parks, the parks that are still open are bearing huge amounts of visitors, so much so that we've had to put capacity thresholds in at places like Enchanted Rock or Pardinalis Falls. But the strain on that infrastructure, and this is really important, is at a very significant point here. And we have got to figure out a way to work successfully with the legislature to help continue investing in that infrastructure. Meanwhile, you know, we're still trying to recover from the floods of 15 and 16. You know, this commission will recall authorizing us to go forward with two capital infrastructure-related requests of the legislature, a request for $49 million to address the flood-related damages at 10 sites across our wildlife management areas and fish hatcheries and a number of parks, plus an $86 million request to keep up the deferred maintenance plans and work that's been going on across the system. What we were appropriated in the current biennium was $66 million, which, you know, certainly is a large number. I want to acknowledge that. $49 million of that was presumed to go to address those 10 sites that suffered damage from the floods, places like Lake Ray Roberts or Somerville or Bastrop State Park. There was roughly $17 million split equally between our Fund 9 and our State Parks Division. Much of those Fund 9 dollars going to address hatchery-related investments. But the roughly $8 million in money that some might perceive as fungible to address capital construction and repair needs across the state park system, which, as you know, is a tiny amount, really has to pay with all of the infrastructure costs, associate team costs associated with monitoring and managing those, also with well over $80 million in construction contracts right now. We're going to have scope changes. We're going to have emergency-related things that we're going to have to pay for. So those funds are spoken for. In the department, we don't have a pot of contingency money. There's no pot of gold off to the side that we can pull from to address these catastrophic-related events. So we had a hearing last week with the Facilities Joint Oversight Committee chaired by Kelly Hancock out of Fort Worth, and we talked about having to step back and essentially reprioritize how we were going to make investments to address these needs. We've already repurposed almost $3 million of the previous flood-related infrastructure dollars to address the immediate needs from Harvey. We're going to probably have to repurpose some more of that for engineering and design work and additional stabilization-related efforts. But also, we need to take note of the fact that particularly in some of these parks that are in flood control-related settings in which we have infrastructure that has a tendency to go underwater every other year, building a lot of vertical infrastructure in those Corps of Engineers leased properties and other facilities doesn't make any sense at all. And we need to revisit how we're thinking about our infrastructure investments in management of those sites. And so I want to foreshadow our thought process in that regard and really prioritize what are the human health, the safety, the public safety related needs that we're going to have to address. And we're working on a revised schedule, and we'll report on that commission as soon as that is finalized. Obviously, a lot of discussion across the state and elsewhere about opportunities to capture reimbursements or funds from FEMA. You can see the areas that are in crosshatch there that are potentially eligible for FEMA-related reimbursement. FEMA is a reimbursement-related program. The parameters for how that works vary from storm to storm. Getting reimbursed for the emergency response, search and rescue is fairly straightforward. And I'm confident that the department has a very, very high probability of getting reimbursed for most, if not all, of that roughly $13 to $16 million initial expenditure on search and rescue. Pursuing FEMA dollars for replacement of damaged capital facilities is a whole different subject. And for better or for worse, we have a lot of experience of that with other storms, which also means that we've learned a lot of lessons. And so just because a property may be eligible for FEMA reimbursement, by no means suggest that we should pursue it, because the amounts of reimbursement vary considerably. We can't match any federal dollars with federal dollars, so funds like our Pittman-Robertson or our Dingell-Johnson funds are ineligible to match. The amount of reimbursement will vary if you're in a flood-prone area, particularly a V-zone, whether or not you've got flood insurance, whether or not you're willing to rebuild your facility exactly like it was built before, even if that was in the 30s or 40s, whether or not you're willing to carry flood insurance in the future, and then all of the attendant requirements that go with that. So I guess here's the message that I want to share with the commission. I don't think we ought to look at FEMA as the golden goose here on this related response, and I would expect that really there's probably just a modicum of properties that will ultimately end up pursuing any reimbursement-related status, but we'll certainly keep you posted as we go. Last but not least, it's just, you know, this was just kind of maybe the symbol of resilience for the department. You know, the big tree there at Goose Island State Park's been around for a little over 1,000 years or so, Brent, and, you know, it's still standing and has some leaves on it. And that tree has weathered a lot of storms, and so too has this department. And not only will we, but so will the coastal communities and the rest of the Texas that were impacted in such large ways by this storm. With that, Mr. Chairman, the Commission, I know that was a long presentation, but obviously this is a big, heavy event, has a significant impact on our budgets and our operations and our programs right now. I want to thank all of the senior leadership that have been so involved, all of our staff out in the field who have just done Herculean efforts to take care of these facilities and sites. They make you proud every single day to see what they're going through and enduring personally and professionally, and the seriousness by which they take their stewardship of these facilities. It's an extraordinary act of public service, and forgive me for being very proud of that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and see if you or the commissioners have any questions.
Well, just an extraordinary effort. Congratulations to everybody. It does make you proud.
Yeah.
Any comments, questions?
I'd just like to comment that after we got the helicopter and our pilots were trained on it and whatnot, a couple of us took a trip. Margaret, I believe you took a trip in the helicopter as well as I did, and I asked them what they had been doing, and this was 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, and they had been training for the cable rescue.
The hoist rescue.
They've been training for that, and they were talking about how that training was going. And then now 2 years later, that training came in. Was not just handy, it was needed.
Yeah.
And so I don't mean to just single out those pilots, because as you've seen, a lot of people did a lot of work at a great sacrifice. But it is an indicator of what this department has done to prepare the response that was given. That didn't just happen. They didn't just wake up the day after Harvey struck and say, hey, let's go get a helicopter and go rescue people, or let's go get a boat, or let's get the trucks together. Our people are trained to do this, and so that's why the response was what it was. As a result, 12,000 people's lives were saved, and they were able to get to them because our people put in the effort beforehand to do what they did when they were needed. And so these other issues of financial and whatnot, we'll figure that out. But kudos to our people who train and study and figure out best practices to help people when they need them.
Yeah, well said, Commissioner. Thank you. Yeah, it pays off. Thank you.
Carter, we received a letter from Chairman Friedkin and Chairman Bass through the foundation, and we were pulling together some funds to help some of the Parks and Wildlife employees that were directly impacted.
Yes, sir.
I know it's a little off topic and it's through the foundation, but could you give us a little update on that? Because I know it was important. Myself and others, you know, wanted to be supportive of it, but can you give us an update?
You bet. And thank you, Commissioner. I can't thank you enough for the show of support and just that generosity of spirit that we saw from the commission and others that were, you know, deeply concerned about the welfare of departmental employees that had suffered so much. Dr. Wheeler has really been our point person on that. I think Pamela just helped me with some of the statistics here. Ultimately, we had over 100 colleagues that were
120.
So almost $300,000 that was raised to help the men and women of the department that were in such dire straits, and 120 that affected is fabulous.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but 100% of the dollars that went into the foundation went out or are slated to go out.
100%.
Remarkable. Fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Commissioner. You're right. You never have to worry about those dollars and where they're going. They're going right where they should. Thank you for bringing that. And again, thank you for the generosity of spirit and support there. I can't tell you what that means to our folks in the field. And many of us saw that personally for colleagues that lost their homes and had families to take care of and were, you know, many weeks away, if not months, from any kind of relief, and to be able to have some kind of a assistance there was huge. Thank you. Wonderful spirit of this department and the commission and the foundation.
Extraordinary. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you, Carter.
Thank you, Chairman. Commissioners.
And next item is work session item number 3, year-end revenues and cash balance projection. Mr. Mike Jensen, please make your presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Mike Jensen, Division Director of Financial Resources. I have a presentation, just it's more of a briefing, to look backwards and look what the hurricane did to the first month of revenues, and then to give you an update from a presentation we had in January 2016, where we talked about our concerns about the dwindling cash balances for General Fund 9. So that's what we're going to do this morning. We're going to look back at the year end, how we fared. We're going to look at September revenues, and then we'll talk about the cash balance concerns. We're going to start with state park revenues. This first slide kind of shows you that we have an upward trend. You can see the average year-to-year growth over the 5 years is approximately 7%. It's about $3.24 million. The average over since about 2015 is closer to 9%, about $4.4 million. During the same time, visitation pretty much mirrors the revenue streams. Visitation over 5 years is about 4%, but over the last 2 years, it's closer to 9 to 10%. You're familiar with this slide. This shows you the cycle of state park revenues. You can see the first 6 months is about 37% of the revenue. Last 6 months, 63%, the peak being in the spring break and the summer months. 2017 displaces 2016 as the best year of record for state park revenues. Best months are July, March, and June. Combined, they're about 34% of the revenue stream. The next slide shows the variances for the different types of categories that we monitor. You can see we ended last fiscal year about 9% ahead revenue-wise. That's about $4.57 million. All the categories exceeded prior year's performance, and the visitation for the same period was close to 10%, about 9.7%. The boat revenue has a cyclical trend similar with state parks, but it's much more flat with respect to year-to-year comparison. Over 5 years, it only has increased approximately half a percentage point per year, about $108,000. Since 2015, because we're including 16, which is the best year of record, that's about 1.5%, about $300,000 per year. If you look at this cycle, the first 6 months account for 29% of the revenue, the last 6 months about 71%. 2016 is the best year of record, and the best months are typically June, May, and July. This next slide shows the variance between the sales tax titles and registrations. You can see that we were behind 2016 because it is the best year of record. We were down about 1.2%, 281,000. The volumes, when you look at those, registrations were down 2.5%. Titles were actually up 2.1%. However, you have to factor in that registration fees account for about two-thirds of all the boat fee revenue. And boat revenue is considered a Fund 9 funding stream. The larger funding stream that contributes to the game, fish, and water safety are license sales. You can look over these the 5 year trend from 12 to license year 17 is about growth of 2.8% per license year, about 2.8 million per year. But if you look at the last 2 or 3 years, it's closer to 3.3 to 3.5%, which is about 3.4 million per year. As you can see, this is very different than the state park revenue, and the boat revenue is front-loaded very heavily because of, by design, we have the license year that starts August 15th of each year. And typically, we have about 75% of the revenue through the first 6 months, but just the first month itself accounts for 41% of the total annual revenues. The best months are September, November, and October. The peak periods for combination and hunting, of course, is September through December. Fishing, September, and then it's March through July. This slide will show you the variances for what we track at a higher level. You can see we ended the year 3% ahead. That's about 3.1 million. If you combine resident and non-resident fishing, we were ahead 5.8%, about 2.2 million. Combined hunting of resident and non-resident, we were actually ahead half a percentage point. It's about 112,000. Combination licenses were ahead 1.2%, about $443,000. Now let's look at what happened with the impact of Hurricane Harvey. Carter hit upon that already. You can look at this chart for State Park. This only shows the first month. And you have to remember that in the prior fiscal year, the revenues for September of last year were probably the highest they'd ever been. So we're about 17% behind, 687,000 just the first month. Most of that's attributed to Harvey. Boat revenue, again, we're behind about 8%. We're behind about 119,000. Again, boat revenue, that's a slow month. The peak periods for boat revenue are going to be the spring and summer. The biggest concern right now is the license revenue. It's approximately 10% behind. It's anywhere from 4.75 million to 5 million. As of today's date, it's roughly about 5 million. I'm not focusing so much on the percentage because as the year goes by, if it hangs at 5 million, by year's end, that'll be about a 4.5% reduction as opposed to the prior license year. The real reason I'm here today is to give you an update from the January 2016 cash balances projections because we were concerned at how Fund 9 looked. Before I start this projection, I'll give you a spoiler. I mean, Fund 9, I'll think back to last night. My daughter was a candy corn witch. Think of Fund 9 as looking like a candy corn. It has three pieces to it. And the general piece is the white tip of the candy corn, and that's the most flexible piece, and that's what always gets spent first because it has less restrictions on it. If we go to the end of 2019, we're projecting cash balances of about $12.5 million. So things are much more improved when we look back 2 years. We were talking to you in January 2016. We were looking at going negative, so we had to take some measures to prevent the department from going negative. And the state park account 64 is projected to have a balance of $49 million at that time. let's dive into Fund 9. I think y'all are all aware of this. I mentioned the candy corn because it really has three components to it. We have the general unrestricted portions of Fund 9, which are the most flexible game, fish, and water safety monies from license sales, from boat revenues. Actually, we track 72 different revenue codes from the comptroller's office, so we don't report to you on every 70, each one of those, but it includes oil and gas, royalties, other types of leases, but it's primarily license fees and boat fees. And these three components I mentioned, it's general, it's dedicated. This slide here shows you the four top stamps that we have. We also have some other sub-accounts that are dedicated related to sand and gravel and some other buyback programs. And then other is made up of donations, appropriated receipts, interagency contracts. From time to time, we have surplus property and equipment that gets sold, and those revenues would come back and we'd put that into other. The next slide was going to show you the balances as of the end of 2017, or how we started this current fiscal year. You can see that the unrestricted piece of general, it's about 15% of the current cash balances. The dedicated pieces, the stamps, are about 75%. The other components, about 10%. Again, on this chart, there are more than just these five categories here. There are others, but there's another $2.4 million in other sub-dedicated accounts from buyback programs, Oyster Shell Recovery, sand and gravel. But this gives you an idea of what the legislature sees. Typically, when the Legislative Budget Board, we call them the LBB, when they provide information to our House and Senate members, they tend to focus on the bottom line. They consider that amount an A fund, which looks pretty healthy at $62.6 million. However, most of our operations, the flexibility that we require for the General Fund 9, you can see $9.2 million is really not a great amount when you compare it to the total bottom line. So when we're testifying, presenting information to the House and Senate members, we have to draw this distinction between general, the dedicated, and the other, so that they don't appropriate us, give us appropriation authority, and expecting us to use stamp funds for things that we are restricted and we cannot use them for. This is a similar graph to what we showed you in January 2016. And this is kind of a historical trend of what happened. If you go back to 2008 and 2009, we were concerned about cash balances at that time, so the department made some concerted efforts to shift to stamps funding whenever possible. When you get to about fiscal year 10, the department had an exceptional item we took to the legislature to increase fees, and we increased fees by approximately 5%, but we also increased expenditures by 5% because those fees went back to an equity pay effort for a large number of positions all across the department. A big note here is what happened around fiscal year 2011. That was when we had some legislative budget cuts. For example, 11, we had a 5% reduction. The biennium of fiscal year 12 and 13, we had reductions in force. We had additional reductions. During periods of reduction, the legislature is not permitting you to spend your cash. So what happens during those times is the cash balances are going to grow, because your authority to spend is lower than what you're actually collecting over time. What happened in about the calendar year 2013, when the legislature convened to do appropriations for 14 and 15, we had requested restoration, and they really restored and they went above the restoration. If you recall, they gave us the $5.2 million for a helicopter. They had some targeted increases for law enforcement, across-the-board salary increases for everybody else. There were some employee benefits and retiree benefits that were increased. So basically, during that period of 14 and 15, the legislature appropriated another approximately $13 million over the biennium to cover these types of salary expenses and benefits, but we did not increase any revenue streams at that point in time. And that $13 million increase in expenses continued in 16 and 17. So you can see that the slope of this line, it concerned us greatly with respect to the white tip of that candy corn, because the unrestricted, the general piece of Fund 9 was going to be spent down to zero if we didn't take some action. So we were on a path to exhausting the fund balances. The next slide is going to show you some things that actually help the outlook. I'm going to go ahead and put all the bullet points on here. The first bullet point on here, you see increased revenue. Our original estimates was conservative. We typically do our estimates for the Legislative Budget Board and the legislature on a conservative basis. We had estimated a growth of approximately 1.5%. Actual growth levels, as I mentioned in earlier slides, was closer to about 3.4 to 4%, and that is inclusive of all the boat revenues and the license revenues and all the oil and gas royalties and lease revenues. So that first billet, we really had a positive impact of about $4 million, $3.9 million. The next bullet, the decreased expenditures and transfers, we took some steps and some measures to relieve the burden by having a hiring chill on all positions that were funded with Fund 9 in the department during that period. And that relieved the burden of approximately $1.9 million. The governor's office in January of this year through August had a hiring freeze. And that had another benefit that relieved the burden on Fund 9, probably approximately $3 to $4 million. And the benefits proportional adjustments that we do, we trued that one up, and that was positive. It relieved the burden by about $1.6 million on benefits. Even with that being said, being conservative and things working out better, the slope was still projected to approach zero pretty quickly. So we had to take some other measures when we prepared the legislative appropriations requests going into the last legislative session. And the next slide. You can tell I didn't do these slides because I would have had them all showing. We prepared the legislative appropriations request. I want to give Julie Horsley credit because when she monitors those 72 revenue objects of expense, it's a lot of detailed work. She and her staff do a great job. I'm very confident in their work. We had to do a method of finance swap, and we also had a 4% reduction schedule where the agency, the legislature actually took the $23 million from that schedule. The method of finance swap relieved the burden on General Fund 9 by $13.4 million. And from the $23 million of 4% reduction schedule, we had another $3.3 million that eased the burden on General Fund 9. So combined, that was $16.7 million relief to General Fund 9, which significantly improved things. Conference Committee made some adjustments. They had some provisions in Article 9, which was contract cost containment. They had some data consolidation provisions and some other provisions. It was roughly $836,000, which relieved the burden on Fund 9. We had some legislative initiatives that were pursued that were adopted. I think you're familiar with House Bill 448. That made the 4% transfer from boat fee revenues monthly permissive. And in August, we asked the commission to grant authorization to retain all boat fees in Fund 9, and that was granted in August. So that is basically $3 million per year over the biennium. That's another $6 million relief that we're not burdening General Fund 9 this biennium. We have Senate Bill 573. Staff and Inland Fisheries worked closely with legislators to make some adjustments to the freshwater stamp, which opened up the permissible uses for a variety of things. And that will relieve the burden on General Fund 9 by approximately $1.2 million this biennium. And as we do our projections and forecasting, Julie and her team have estimated and projected, they're assuming a one-time decline of about $10.6 million in overall Fund 9 during this fiscal year related to Harvey. We can see up front that license sales accounts for probably about $5 million of that. We're assuming another 5% decline over all Fund 9 streams through the remainder of the year. I think that's very conservative. I don't think it's going to be that bad. But at the same time, we can sustain that level. We're assuming that when we approach the next fiscal year, the second fiscal year of this biennium, that we will return to the performance of fiscal year 2017 and license year 2017, because that's typically been what happens after natural disasters. We saw that happen after the fires. We saw that happen after the prior hurricane, where we restored to the prior year. The next slide, this one shows the positive impact to General Fund 9. You can see starting in 14 and 15, the appropriation authority was reinstated. The legislature authorized additional changes. Expenses outpaced revenues significantly. Then you can see the figures in 16 and 17 show that expenditures continue to exceed revenues by an average of $5.5 million each year. But because of the adjustments to the LAR we just mentioned, the method of finance swaps, the relief that we got from the 4% schedule and the other decisions that were made with the legislation, we're seeing a positive swing in fiscal year 19. And the gap between revenues and expenses becomes smaller, and in 19 we actually see that appropriated levels, barring any other unforeseen catastrophic events, we expect revenues to outpace expenditures. The next slide is going to show the projection for General Fund 9 through the end of this biennium. And so you can see how it dips. The reason it's dipping like that is we're accounting for the impact, the adverse impact of Hurricane Harvey. I mentioned we built in, we're assuming we're going to be short $10.6 million in the General Fund 9 stream. And this chart is only showing you the tip of that candy corn. It's not showing you the impact on stamp balances. It's not showing you the impact on other. It's just showing you the impact on General Fund 9. So you can see for 2018, the projection reflects a 7.1 ending balance. But for 2019, we're projecting a balance of $12.5 million, which is pretty favorable, all things considered. We're very fortunate that the legislature accepted our method of finance swaps and that we got the legislation and that we got sponsors and we worked with them and those bills were passed. So these four bullet points kind of summarize the current outlook. The bottom line is, barring any catastrophic events, we have enough cash to get through this biennium, and we're projecting a $12.5 million general fund 9 balance at the end of this biennium. The growth is going to continue, but it's going to slow each year, mainly because of expected increases in ERS shared cash. They do take some of our cash to pay for benefits for retirees who retired from the department. At current projections, we expect a growth of about $4 million in 2020. This is going to slow down to about $2.7 million in 2021, and it's probably going to be about that level or lower moving forward. And this is all under one very important assumption. We're assuming the appropriation levels of 18 and 19. So if the legislature elects to increase our appropriation levels, then we'll have to come back to the table and figure out what we can do. Because really, $12.5 million is not a huge reservoir to satisfy exceptional request items. Although we do have dedicated stamp balances that are available, and we've tried in the past to access those. We'll try again as we approach this next legislature. We have opportunities with unclaimed refund and motorboat fuel tax, which is considered a Fund 1 source. And we also have the sporting goods sales tax opportunity. And with that, I'm going to have one slide on the state parks accounts cash balance projections. Unlike the license revenue, the Fund 9 revenue, boat revenue, there are only 54 revenue objects that we track for this one. The primary two components are state park fees and transfers in from sporting goods sales tax. We've had significant growth in state park entrance fees. We've mentioned that. You saw that in the earlier slides. The last 2 years, visitation's been about 10% above prior years, and revenues have been up about 10% as well. The estimate that we have in 64 is also factoring in a 4% decline in general state park revenues associated to Hurricane Harvey. And we're also factoring in a discontinuation of $3 million per year from boat fees. Prior to this fiscal year, we would transfer on a monthly basis 15% of all boat fees that were collected. We're not doing that this year. Those fees are going to be retained in Fund 9. And we had pretty healthy balances going into the last legislative session. This last bullet on there, sub-bullet, is no additional authorities approved by the legislature. We did have exceptional items requesting funding from the state parks account. Unfortunately, it wasn't granted to us this time, but our projection is going to be $49 million, so hopefully we'll be able to have a more compelling plea for some specific state park type funding initiatives as we develop the legislative appropriations request in this upcoming summer. So basically, things are much better from the standpoint of General Fund 9, and things have been pretty good in the last couple of years on the state parks account 64. That's all I have for this update today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Remind me of the dedicated up to 94% of the sporting goods sales tax. What amount was appropriated for our budget?
I have that in my other, but I can get that to you.
If you'll just,
I can get that to you. It's
okay,
a
thank you.
Mike, wasn't it roughly 88%?
We got about
87.5%. Yeah, I think
it was
more or less.
The BRE was like $331 million, and I'm probably wrong on the figure, but it was, I think we got 87.5% of that, of our 94% of that. So you got to take 94% to 331, which I think is 313 or 311.
and then we got 87.5% of that. Okay. But I can get you the exact figure.
So we didn't get all that could have been dedicated to us in the appropriation.
We did not, but we did pretty good.
If you look to historic,
I mean, the last biennium, they did 100%, but that's the first biennium they ever did that. If you look at prior years, it was closer to anywhere from 39% to 52, 55%. So we're going to go for broke again. We're going to try to get 100%, but at the same time, 87.5% was very good.
Better than previous biennium's before the
absolutely
the last one. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike, for your presentation. We'll move on to work session item number 4. If we've nonprofit partner rules, we recommend adoption of proposed changes. And does any commissioner have any questions about number 4? If not, I will place the nonprofit partner rules on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 5. Carter, do we want to go over that?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Number 5, the coastal management area classification has been discussed.
You know, we talked about that before, Chairman. I'll really defer to the commission. I don't remember a lot of questions about that. I think probably the discussion tomorrow should suffice.
That would be.
That work for you?
Okay. If no commissioner has any further questions, we'll place coastal management area classification conduct rules on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 6, statewide recreational and commercial fishing proclamation review. Ken, please make the presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski, the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to preview some of the changes we're considering to the freshwater fishing regulations. This year, for this regulatory cycle, we're focusing on largemouth bass regulations. Just to go over a little bit of our goals in largemouth management. We manage for diverse opportunities in the state. There's really no such thing as an average angler. They have a diverse desires, and we're blessed in Texas to have a diverse resource that we can manage from reservoirs that provide a lot of productivity to large sizes, small sizes, and we look at that, and we feel we can accommodate the desires of anglers and manage those for those opportunities from high catch rates all the way up to trophy bass fishing. Looking at length and bag limits, those are one of our most important management tools that we've used over the years. We've primarily focused on length limits over the years, as that seems to have the most impact on our populations. And this is a more important management tool for achieving our management goals. Our goals have always been to maximize angling opportunity and improve fishing quality. And the thing about harvest regulations, they manage both the fish and the anglers. We always want to consider what the anglers want out of the fisheries, and those social aspects of it are something we always consider, but there has to be a underlying biological basis that we have to address to produce the desired results. Over time, bass are our most managed species. We first started managing with special regulations in 1979 when we implemented some 16-inch minimum length limits. At that time, statewide was 10 inches and a 10-fish bag. And those first two reservoirs that we implemented those on were Lake Nacogdoches, not too far from here, and Fayette County Reservoir. In the following year, we saw the first use of a 14-inch, 5-fish bag, which later became the statewide in 1986, and that was put on Lake Fork when it was first opened. In 1991 was the first use of a 14 to 18 inch slot. We implemented that on a couple of power plant lakes, Monticello in East Texas and Lake Calaveras. Over this time, since the late early 80s, we've certainly seen the catch and release ethic among our anglers increased. These regulations are designed to have directed harvest. Harvest is an important component of that, and over time we've seen the increasing catch and release have an impact on how these regulations function. So we've considered that over time and recently in the effectiveness of the regulations. To kind of put in perspective our use of special regulations on our state reservoirs, looking at the major reservoirs in the state, those reservoirs 500 acres and over, we kind of categorize these by the minimum length limits, have the similar management objectives. Primarily that's the statewide 14-inch. We have that 12-inch minimum that we implemented in southeast Texas a few years ago, and also a few lakes with 16-inch limited. And those comprise the bulk of the waters in the state that we're managing with those. Then we go to those special regulations, the various slots that we have, higher minimum length limits, catch and release, and other regulations. And we have about 30 of those, which comprise about 18% of the public waters. When you look at the public impoundments in the state on a whole, there's about 1,100, and you would add another 30 locations with special regulations. So we think we've been judicious in the use of those and tried to target areas where we could have some impacts. As I said, our focus this year is on largemouth bass regulations. We always have an ongoing process of our staff evaluating those, but this year we took a particular look at largemouth bass regulation, review those special regulations to ensure they're meeting our management goals, and if we could move those to a more appropriate regulation, we would consider that. We were looking to kind of standardize and simplify to reduce some of the complexity, but still at the same time looking to always maintain the fishing quality in those locations where we were considering changing regulations. And in this round of evaluation review process, we targeted some specific regulation categories, those 14 to 18 and 14 to 24 inch slots. As I mentioned, over time, the harvest of fish among anglers has decreased, more catch and release, and these two particular regulations, those slots were designed to allow people to harvest some fish below the 14 inches. We haven't seen a lot of that, so we've considered that, and also the 16 inch minimum. So our first grouping of reservoirs that were, we've got 12 reservoirs here that we're looking at to change, and a few at the 16-inch minimum, Lake Granberry, Possum Kingdom, the somewhat elusive Lake Ratcliffe, which isn't too far from here, have three reservoirs with 18-inch minimums, Lake Bryan, Cooper, Old Mount Pleasant City Lake, and then we have six in the 14 to 18-inch slot, Bridgeburg, Burke Crenshaw, Georgetown, Madisonville, San Augustine City, and Sweetwater, and we're considering changing those back to the 14-inch minimum length limit and five fish a daily bag, which are the statewide limits. And here's sort of the distribution of and the sizes of those lakes around the state, from all the way from Cooper down to Burke Crenshaw, which is 10 acres down in the Houston area. We have a couple of reservoirs that have catch and release, with an exception that allows anglers to keep a bass over 24 inches that has over 13 pounds for the Share Lunker program, Purtis Creek State Park Lake, and also Lake Raven, which is in Huntsville State Park. And we are considering changing those to our 16-inch maximum length limit with five fish daily bag. And what the 16-inch maximum is, it allows anglers to harvest bass under 16 inches, but the only way an angler could take a fish over 16 inches, it would have to be over 24 inches, over 13 pounds, and be accepted for the Share Lunker program. Next, we have those 14 to 24-inch slot limit lakes. All those are power plant reservoirs, Fayette County Reservoir, Gibbons Creek, and Lake Monticello, and we're changing those, proposing to change those to 16 to 24-inch slot limit, which is what we have on Lake Fork, and that'll give us one category that for the large slot limits. One additional 14 to 18-inch lake, Grapevine in the Metroplex, we're considering changing that to our no minimum length limit regulation, which allows you to harvest fish of any size, but you are limited to two fish less than 18 inches. We have that have this regulation on three reservoirs, a couple out in West Texas and Lake Jacksonville, and so far it's been well received by the anglers and is producing some good fishing in those reservoirs. Additionally, we have two locations that we're considering the regulation changes on. These are outside of the review process. Bellwood in Tyler currently has an 18-inch minimum. We're considering to changing that to the 16-inch maximum. And also Davy Crockett Lake, a lake in Caddo National Grassland, that has a 14-inch slot limit, and we're considering to changing that back to the 16-inch maximum also. What we're looking to do there with this moving these lakes particularly to the 16-inch maximum, we're looking to maintain, increase the abundance of the larger bass. A couple of lakes have produced some larger fish. It would allow our anglers to harvest the bass less than 16 inches. And these are smaller reservoirs compared to some of our other reservoirs, have limited capacity to produce larger bass. So we think this is a good fit for these reservoirs. Additionally, in your book, we did have listed that we are considering another change on Lake Lakewood, a lake near Leander. The city is proposing to put a new park on that. We have still have to work out some issues about property around that lake and how the city is going to manage that. So at this time, we're not going to move that one forward. And just to circle back to look at our regular review process of back regulations. If these ones we're considering, if we propose them in January and you later approve them in March, we would completely eliminate the 14 to 24-inch slot category. We reduce the lakes in the 14 to 18-inch slot category from 10 to 2. We have two existing lakes, Lake Nasworthy and San Angelo. We put that out a few years ago. We want to continue evaluating that. And also Cattle Lake, which we co-manage with Louisiana. We would have to have discussions with Louisiana. We meet with them frequently to consider regulatory changes, so this is something we would consider discussing with them in the future. On the 16-inch minimums, we would take that one down from four locations to one. We have one existing one, we Lake Conroe. The anglers there are pretty fond of that regulation. We still don't think it's going to have a big impact one way or 16 or 14, so that's one we're going to continue looking at. And that category of special regulations on reservoirs 500 acres and larger would reduce from 30 down to 21. So those are the changes we're considering for the upcoming regulatory cycle. If you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to address those at this time.
Any questions?
I've got just a couple of general questions. I'm not personally much into fishing. I'm more hunting fowl and large animals, whatnot. What's the targeted group that we are typically trying to address with our regulations? And let me be more clear. In my head, I have this viewpoint that, you know, a bass fisherman has a truck, a boat, five or six rods, a Yeti, and, you know, a fairly decent income to be able to afford to go and catch the bass, catch and release, whatnot. And I guess my question is, I just want to make sure that, you know, the granddad that wants to take the grandson out doesn't have a boat and can go and fish and catch the bass and keep it and eat it if he wants and, you know, whatever. I'm just trying to make sure that in my head I'm clear that we're targeting a complete audience of people who may want to bass fish.
Well, yes, certainly there's, you know, as I mentioned, there really isn't an average angler. Your characterization of a bass angler is probably what most people think of, and certainly those are some of our most avid bass fishermen, the people that have the large bass boats. Some of them fish tournaments, and a lot of those catch and release. But, you know, we've tried to, when we look at our lakes around the state, we do have a lot of lakes that are under that 14-inch five fish limit you could, you know, harvest fish out of those lakes. You know, we look specifically like at some of those state park lakes, Lake Raven Lake Raven and Purtis Creek. We're putting a 60-inch maximum. Just there's a lot of bank angling on those lakes. Previously, they were catch and release. Now we're moving them to where if you're out there with your son and your daughter and he catches a 12-inch bass, he could keep it now if it's his first fish. So we've certainly considered that, you know, in our regulations, and we've tried to, you know, manage that for those diverse opportunities on a statewide basis.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And Mr. Lance Robinson, are you? Please make your presentation.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Lance Robinson with Coastal Fisheries, and I'm here today to speak to you about a possible regulation change for king mackerel in the Gulf of Mexico. In May of this year, the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council approved and the NOAA Fisheries implemented Amendment 26 of the Fishery Management Plan for the Coastal Migratory Pelagics Fishery in the Gulf of Mexico. Part of that management plan stipulated that the bag limit for king mackerel would be increased for recreational anglers from 2 fish to 3 fish per day. What that does, in the state of Texas, our current bag limit is 2 fish per person per day. And so it creates a situation where we have a daily bag limit in federal waters that is more liberal than what is allowed in state waters. And this certainly can provide a situation where it could limit some opportunity to Texas recreational anglers. Looking at some of the catch rates of this species over the last 20 years, it's been very stable in Texas, and so we think this is certainly an opportunity that I think will be beneficial to recreational fishermen of Texas. And so we're here before you today to propose increasing this bag limit in Texas waters from 2 fish to the 3 fish per person per day, and that would be brought before you in January for final action. So with that, I will try to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner Scott.
I'm assuming, and we know what that does sometimes to us, where you've got Louisiana, Mississippi regulation change in process, since we're working so well with the other states on our red snapper issue, are they trying to go to the 3 limit as well on in Louisiana and Mississippi?
For Spanish or king mackerel?
Yeah, for the yes, mackerel.
Yes, sir. Those two states are implementing that change right now as we speak. The same thing that we're proposing, to go to 3 fish in their state waters. Alabama and Florida have already done so.
So we're going to stay pretty much together as the group that it is, to try to get all of these federal issues resolved at kind of like at one time. We don't have to go to the federal for this one, though, right?
For this one, we do not. No, sir. What this one is doing is actually the feds have already changed it to 3 fish, and so it puts us in a situation where anglers in Texas, if you're fishing in federal waters, you're allowed to keep 3 fish, but you can only land whatever is in place in state waters. So there's a discrepancy there. We have a lower bag limit. So this would actually increase opportunity for our anglers.
Okay. Thank you.
And the fishery will withstand, obviously, the increase. I just was looking at your chart.
Yes, sir. There's in federal waters, there's an allocation that is appropriated every year for recreational and commercial. Recreational fishery has not been hitting the total poundage that's been allocated to that fishery in federal waters. This is an opportunity to try to allow recreational anglers to get closer to what is actually allowed by the federal government, and this just gives our Texas anglers some additional opportunity as well.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for your presentation. Work session item number 7, statewide hunting proclamation preview. Mr. Sean Oldenberger.
Good morning, Chairman and fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Oldenberger, small game program director in the Wildlife Division. Today here I'm to present some potential 2018-19 migratory and resident game bird regulations briefings and potential changes that may occur. Today's briefing and current process is we're going to outline some potential changes as said for the 2018-19 season, and then we're also going to basically state that those to establish the migratory and resident regulations at the same time. If you may recall, a couple of years ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service changed the process for setting migratory game bird regulations. So that does allow this to be a little bit easier in going through to November for the briefing, January for the proposals, and then March for the final adoption. The migratory information is available for the 2018-19 season. We do use prior year's information now based on that new regulation cycle. Last month, we met with Fish and Wildlife Service in Minneapolis with Service Regulations Committee, and so now federal frameworks are established for the 2018-19 migratory game bird hunting seasons. All frameworks are basically unchanged for waterfowl, dove, and other migratory birds, except for the South Texas Dove Zone, and we'll go into that. Here are the federal frameworks for waterfowl, for ducks and geese. Ducks, you can open to the Saturday nearest September 24th and go to the Sunday nearest January 31st. Geese, Saturday nearest September 24th and the Sunday nearest February 15th. All packages for ducks are liberal this year, and there's no change for geese. Obviously, within are the number of days we're allowed. We do go later in the season due to being a wintering state. Federal frameworks for doves, season length and daily bag limits remain unchanged. We are allowed 3 zones for doves with no more than 2 segments. The north and central can open September 1st and go until January 25th. The south dove season, which is a change, can open September 14th and go to January 25th. Previously, the opening framework for the south zone for doves was the Friday nearest September 21st, but no earlier than September 17th. And so now that's allowed for a fixed date. Basically, what we did there is we are going to allow dove hunting on every weekend in Texas, and so that's why the September 14th was pushed by the Central Flyway to the Fish and Wildlife Service on that. We are also allowed their special white-winged dove days, 4 days in early September, and typically we do those the first 2 full weekends in September. No change for all other migratory game birds. Potential changes that are going to occur. We do know daily bag limits now for the 18-19 season. We are glad to see that pintails will be increased from 1 per day to 2 per day, so that'll be good for our waterfowl hunters here in Texas, where we do have a substantial number of wintering pintails. For doves, as I said, we were allowed to open as early as September 14th for the opening day of the South Zone now for the 2018-19 hunting season. All other migratory game birds will coincide with waterfowl seasons and basically calendar adjustments where necessary. I'm going to go into proposed wild turkey regulation changes. We do have a couple things here regarding one of our zones in East Texas here, so the location is fitting. Currently, we have open and hunting seasons on turkeys during the spring season in Texas in 180 counties. I'd like to note here with the one gobbler eastern zone is where we're located, and the one gobbler western zone, those are where we're only allowed one bird per the spring season. And then there's 15 counties there, the one gobbler eastern zone. So those are where potential changes may occur. So those two counties that are outlined there in check marks in the gray area that went from blue to gray, those would be potentially, they would be deemed possible closure counties. I would like to note that southeastern county there was incorrectly put, so the two counties are St. Augustine and Upshur counties as ones that meet the closure criteria. A couple years ago, Texas Parks and Wildlife established some closure criteria in regards to these eastern wild turkey populations, and so with mandatory reporting now in these counties, basically if they have average one bird over 3 years, then staff will look at whether we need to close these counties for turkey season in the spring or not. And so staff will definitely look at those counties coming up, and in January we'll bring forth if those staff recommends closures in those counties for the 18-19 season. That's just to look at these counties a little bit closer. And so that's where that is in this area. Also to note, one thing that we may look at is there are some perceived declines or maybe some real declines occurring with eastern wild turkeys throughout the southeastern states. And in regards to that, the Southeastern Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies did a white paper last year looking at the timing of opening seasons for spring turkey seasons. When they produced that white paper, one thing they should look at and a recommendation that did come out of that is to basically open seasons no earlier than when 50% of the hens are basically starting nesting. And when we look at present data with regards to this population, the mean nest initiation time for this population occurs around April 22nd. So we've actually put a bunch of transmitters on birds with the restoration efforts we've had in East Texas, as Mr. Smith stated earlier. And so when we look at all that information, that tends to be about the timing of when those 50% of initiations occur. So staff are going to look at that and to see if that is a possible proposal that may come forth to you in January as far as decreasing the season length in this eastern zone. Currently, it does open April 15th and runs to May 14th, and so a possible proposal would be opening that April 22nd. Proposals will be developed by staff. Obviously, one thing we have not done yet is we've not worked with our advisory committees, both the resident and migratory bird committees. That will happen this month. They will review and provide input on these potential changes. Final staff proposals will be presented to the commission in January and then approval in March. With that, it concludes my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the commissioners?
Thank you.
Thank you. It's Sean Gray.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Gray. I'm the mule deer and pronghorn program leader. And this morning, I'd like to give you a preview on potential proposals to mule deer regulation changes this January. This map illustrates our current mule deer seasons in the state. The yellow-colored counties have a 16-day general season that starts the Saturday before Thanksgiving with a special archery season. The red-colored counties have a 9-day general season that starts the Saturday before Thanksgiving with no special archery season. And in the Trans-Pecos, those green-colored counties, we have a 17-day general season starting the Friday after Thanksgiving with a special archery season. All general seasons are buck-only. And the gray-colored counties have a closed mule deer season. And notice that we have one county left in that 9-day season block. Therefore, this January, we'd like to propose to open Linn County, which is that purple-colored county, as a 9-day buck-only general season county, and that would be consistent with the red-colored counties in that area of the Panhandle. You may recall that staff proposed opening Linn County in 2014. However, a petition letter was sent from the members of the Tahoka community to the commission opposing a mule deer season in Linn County. The letter stated that TPWD had limited data regarding the mule deer population and that TPWD could not adequately provide enough resources to patrol for poachers if a season opened up in Linn County. To address the limited population data issue for the Linn County area, staff delineated a new mule deer monitoring unit in 2014. In this area, survey transects are flown annually per our statewide mule deer population monitoring protocol. And the purple area in the map represents this new monitoring unit, and it contains over 360,000 acres. Since 2014, the population surveys indicate an average of about 2,000 mule deer or a density of approximately 200 acres per mule deer. The average sex ratio is 2 does to 1 buck and an average fawn crop of over 70%. These data support that there is no biological concern opening a new buck-only mule deer season in Linn County. Local staff recently contacted 18 landowners in Linn County. 12 supported the season and 3 were neutral. Only three landowners were against a season in Linn County because they believed it would lead to more trespassing and poaching on their properties. The next possible proposal deals with an experimental mule deer antler restriction. Over the last 20 to 25 years in the Southeast Panhandle, excessive buck harvest has been occurring primarily because of increased lease hunting and the popularity of mule deer hunting. This excessive buck harvest has affected sex ratios, with our survey data indicating a postseason sex ratio of 5 to 6 does per buck. In addition, intensive buck harvest has also impacted age structure of the herd. And these data support that mature mule deer bucks in the Southeast Panhandle are a very rare occurrence, as noted in this picture here. Therefore, staff over the last several years have gotten many requests from landowners and hunters to improve the age structure of the mule deer in this area of the Panhandle. Many locals remember the type of mule deer buck that could be produced in this part of the state. The buck in the newspaper article was harvested in 1988 in Hall County, which had 21 points and a spread of over 30 inches. In addition, the success of the current whitetail deer antler restriction has proven that an antler restriction using antler width works for improving buck age structure. In 2016, staff began collecting specific antler and ear measurements to potentially develop a mule deer antler restriction. Initial data indicate that an antler restriction might be able to be used to improve buck age structure. Staff are considering an experimental mule deer antler restriction in 6 counties in the Southeast Panhandle, colored blue in the map. These counties would be Briscoe, Hall, Childress, Floyd, Motley, and Cottle. Most western states have tried an antler point restriction, such as a minimum of 4 points on one side, with no significant improvement in age structure. This is because many young deer meet these minimum standards. And using the whitetail deer antler restriction as a model, staff have collected data on captured mule deer during ongoing research projects and hunter-harvested mule deer in the Panhandle to estimate the ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread and the alert position for bucks. The average ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread for mule deer bucks is about 21 inches, which is demonstrated in the picture. Based upon preliminary data collected on the ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread and antler measurements, the success of the white-tailed deer antler restriction and requests from landowners and hunters in the Southeast Panhandle, staff would like to test an antler restriction using an outside spread of 20 inches, since the average ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread is 21 inches. The outside spread is estimated in a similar manner as the inside spread, but we use the outside measurement of the antler material. This illustration will be used to demonstrate what type of buck can be harvested or those that will be protected with the potential mule deer antler restriction. So again, using the average ear-tip-to-ear-tip measurement and alert position as a guide, which is 21 inches, and that's shown by the blue dashed lines on both buck drawings, the buck on the left would be a legal buck with an outside spread of 20 inches or greater. It would not be legal to harvest the buck on the right because the outside spread is less than 20 inches. And even young deer, their ear-tip-to-ear-tip spread is about 21 inches. Unbranched antlered bucks with an outside spread of less than 20 inches would also be illegal for harvest, as shown in these examples. And our main goal is to get more mule deer bucks into older age classes. And most unbranched antler bucks are yearlings. And allowing more yearlings to be harvested can significantly impact future age structure, especially during drought. Mule deer populations are much lower than white-tailed deer populations and can be more sensitive to overharvest. Preliminary data analysis suggests that an antler restriction with an outside spread of 20 inches should protect at least 80% of 1.5 to 3.5 year old bucks, and about 80% of bucks 5.5 years old or older would be available for harvest. So therefore, staff would like to propose in January an experimental antler restriction in 6 counties in the Southeast Panhandle for at least 4 hunting seasons to test the effectiveness of an outside spread antler restriction to improve the age structure of mule deer bucks within this area. Again, any buck with an outside spread of 20 inches or greater would be legal for harvest. Thus, any buck with a spread of 20 inches or less would not be legal to harvest regardless of unbranched antlers. The experimental antler restriction will not apply to MLDP properties. As part of the MLDP program, TPWD sets property-specific bag limits, and for mule deer are generally conservative. Staff will monitor success of the experimental antler restriction using population surveys such as sex ratios and voluntary check stations to collect more antler and ear measurements, as well as buck age structure data. We also plan to send out opinion surveys to gauge landowner and hunter support before and after the experiment. And just to wrap up, staff would like to propose this January a new mule deer season in Linn County and test an antler restriction in Briscoe, Hall, Childers, Floyd, Motley, and Caudle counties. And this concludes my portion of the statewide preview. Before I turn it over to Alan Kane, I'd like to address any questions y'all might have.
Any questions?
I have a quick law enforcement question. When we set antler size restrictions, do we have a system by which we hold the taxidermist responsible or liable if they don't let us know if someone brings in?
I'd have to turn that over to Ellis Powell.
Or the processor.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ellis Powell. I'm the Wildlife Law Administrator. I believe I heard your question to be, is there a system to hold a processor or taxidermist responsible for that? Well, to answer that question, we don't hold them specifically responsible. We do checks in those facilities. And if it was an illegal deer, again, to gain compliance, we would use discretion, especially in experimental education warnings such as that. But we can track those animals back to the hunter through their logs and through the tags that are at those facilities. So if Commissioner Jones brought one in and I was at Commissioner Moran's facility, I would contact you. I'd get your information from him.
So we basically use the taxidermist as a gathering spot for places where we can check to see if people are hunting and harvesting illegal deer.
That's primarily not how we do it. If we had a specific complaint or we had an issue with a specific facility for some other reason, we typically don't go there and check them. Just we don't want to single out any one facility over another. Typically, at those places, a biologist do survey data checks like that, voluntary compliance checks. Generally, our patrols are in the field is where we would make contact with them.
Do we ever get tips from taxidermists who say, you didn't hear this from me, but you might want to come by here and look at this?
We do from time to time.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
I guess the only reason I'm questioning going through this series of questions, I'm just trying to figure out how do we catch hunters who do this, other than you just happen to pull somebody over or catch somebody with a deer on the hood of their car. But the antlers don't look right.
That's the tricks of our trades. We're out there patrolling and checking deer camps. The game wardens in the local areas know the crossroads, the gathering points, the cafes, landowner communication. It's all a big process, but that is a component, checking these facilities, but it's not a major component. That's not primarily how we do it.
Okay.
I'm glad you clarified that. I was thinking you were setting something up.
I just want to make sure I know where to take it.
Hey, Bill, the only problem is in South Texas, not up in New York.
I got a quick question.
Just a minor point. I'm assuming from reading these, you've got the four-year test season and everything. I'm assuming that everybody is kind of supporting this program out there. Is that an accurate statement?
That would be an accurate statement from the preliminary, intel that we've done so far. And a lot of the requests that we're getting, they're coming to us and asking us to do something about it.
So we're going to still go through the normal process.
Yes.
If we put it on the deal to January, you're still
right.
Going to have to do
your survey.
Yeah,
we're going to go out to public hearings. We're planning at least two public hearings, if not three, in this area.
Yeah, okay. So I just want to check on that.
I have one question. I may have missed it. How did you pick the six counties?
So those six counties, typically the Panhandle has a much higher harvest rate compared to the Trans-Pecos, and out of the Panhandle, that area is kind of the worst part of the Panhandle. So the Panhandle, we have more hunter harvest, and then that specific area, it's even greater than what we generally see on average in the whole Panhandle. And again, we've had multiple requests from hunters and landowners within that area that they would like to see this happen. So that's kind of how we picked them.
All right. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Any other questions? All right. We'll move on to Alan Kane and your presentation.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Alan Kane. I'm the Whitetail Deer Program Leader. And this morning, I'm going to review several potential proposals staff would like to bring forward in January. The first proposal is a housekeeping matter to clarify that MLDP tags are not required to take antlerless deer on U.S. Forest Service, Corps Engineer, or River Authority lands. During our previous process, a statewide process last year of cleaning up regulations related to the new MLD changes, staff intended to remove references regarding antlerless deer permits in the county regulations, and which included MLD permits at the time. During that process, MLD tags were inadvertently left in the statewide regulations, and that language simply needs to be removed. All staff do not anticipate other changes to statewide regulations. Staff do intend to review the language regarding deer harvest on Forest Service, Corps lands, and River Authority lands to ensure that there's no unintended consequences as a result of this housekeeping change, and also to clarify the regulations, make sure they're clear for the harvest antlerless deer on these particular properties. The next item for consideration is a result from a petition for rulemaking request in which the petitioner requested that general deer season be standardized statewide and start on the first Saturday in November and end on the third Sunday in January. Currently, all counties with the whitetail deer general season open on the first Saturday in November. However, the ending dates between the north zone, which is those counties in that white or kind of yellow color, differ between the closing date of the south zone, which is those counties in green. So in the north zone, general season closes the first Sunday in January. In the south zone, it closes the third Sunday in January. Prior to 2001, the south zone season opened 2 weeks later, and it also closed at that third Sunday in January. But it had the same season length as the north zone, so about the same amount of days to hunt, about 2 months there during that general season. It's just one opened later, the south zone did. However, in 2001, the department standardized the opening of general season statewide to be that first Saturday in November, but we didn't modify the closing of the general season to make those standardized. And therefore, the South Zone hunters have an extra 2 weeks of general season to hunt that's not afforded to the North Zone hunters. Staff see no biological reason not to consider standardizing the close of general deer season statewide to be that third Sunday in January, provided the commission would like for us to proceed with this proposal in January. Standardizing the close of general season would also necessitate moving the muzzleloader season, the late use season, and the special late season back 2 weeks. As a result, this would help simplify the regulations for hunters and provide additional hunting opportunity. Staff do not believe there to be any significant biological impacts that result from this possible regulation change, because the majority of the harvest occurs during that general season, but from the open day to the last day of December. And if you look at the days of harvest through our big game harvest surveys, most of the harvest peaks around opening weekend and the holidays, so Thanksgiving and that week around Christmas there. And then although we still have special late season, South Texas general season, MLD season, U season, muzzleloader season are still going on from January 1 and on, it only accounts for about 13% of the harvest during that time frame, so relatively little harvest during that time period. We don't believe that there would be any population level impacts on the deer population in the North Zone counties. Our population data indicates a stable to increasing trend under the current harvest regulations. There may be some concerns from some individuals that claim deer season's already too long, that hunters may harvest shed antler bucks, that extending the general season in the other season, the muzzleloader and the youth season, would interfere with quail season, squirrel hunting with dogs in East Texas, and predator calling contests that occur during these winter months that generally close after they generally start up after the close of general season. The last item staff would be considering bringing forward a proposal in January is also results of a petition for rulemaking request from the Crossman Corporation, in which they requested that air bows and big bore air rifles of .357 caliber or larger be made legal for harvested big game in Texas. Additionally, since that request, which we had back in the spring, I've had a number of informal requests from big bore air rifle enthusiasts, air gun dealers in the state, and just folks that hunt with air rifles or air bows in Texas, asking that the commission and the department consider moving forward with some regulation changes that allow the harvest of big game with these big bore air rifles and air bows. Our current regulations specify that any legal firearm may be used to harvest alligators, game birds, and game animals. Those firearms would include centerfire rifles, handguns, muzzleloaders, or any shotguns, and any of those top firearms with a silencer. Our regulations, however, do provide an exception that prohibits the hunting of alligator, deer, pronghorn, and bighorn sheep with rimfire ammunition or a fully automatic firearm. TPWD regulations prohibit the take of native big game species with air rifles and air bows because air bows and air rifles are not defined as legal firearm or as a firearm or legal archer equipment either under our regulations, the Texas Penal Code, or under the federal firearms regulations. However, our regulations do allow the take of squirrels with air rifles, and because TPWD does not regulate exotic species in the state, it is legal for a hunter to harvest exotic big game or other exotic species with air rifles and air bows in the state. In reviewing what other state wildlife agencies allow with regards to air bows and air rifles, we found that 7 states allow the harvest of big game with air bows, and then 8 states allow the harvest of big game with air rifles. The requirements for the use of air bows and big bore air rifles vary by state. They all restrict the use of air bows or air rifles to the firearm season, so they don't allow it during a primitive firearm season or a archery season or some other season. It's all restricted to the general firearm season. They do require, at least most of the states require, that the external charging mechanism to pressurize the air bow or the air gun, so it's an air tank or pump or compressor. And the reason they do that is to differentiate that from a firearm, which when you propel the bullet, it's caused by an explosion when you strike the primer on the shell and it explodes the gunpowder versus a burst of air. And so that's why that external charging mechanism language is common throughout the other states. Some states do provide minimum caliber sizes. One state does provide minimum velocity requirements and arrow lengths for air bows, and I believe that's Maryland. But they all have some basic regulations surrounding these air rifles and air bows. So I want to take a few moments to illustrate what some of these air rifles and air bows look like and how they function. To start off, these devices are not cheap and generally start around $800 for some of the basic models, but they can be range in price up to several thousand dollars, and that's just for the air rifle, air bow. That doesn't include costs for the other equipment that's required, such as external air tanks, scopes, or arrows, and the lead cast bullets that they use. There are a number of different brands of big bore air rifles that project bullets ranging in size from 30 caliber to 58 caliber. And essentially, how they function is you fill a reservoir, high pressure reservoir with air up to 3,000 psi, I think, in these air bows or air rifles. The air bow is pictured on the top left. Basically, it uses arrow with a hollow shaft that slides over a cylinder, as you can see in the in that air bow. And then when you depress the trigger on that or an air rifle, it causes a pin to basically to push in, a spring to push in on the reservoir holding air, then it allows a burst of air to project the bullet or the arrow. So as mentioned previously, TPWD regulations do not specify minimum requirements for bullet weights, muzzle velocity, muzzle energy for the various legal means to take with firearms in the state. But there's some questions by individuals that may ask whether the big bore air rifles have sufficient energy or velocity make them capable of harvesting big game. And so even though we don't have some minimum standards for our legal firearms, I did want to provide some comparisons for your knowledge here. And so take, for example, the Air Force Texan, which is a big bore air rifle. It's a 45 caliber air rifle. Shoots about a 340 grain bullet, and it has a muzzle velocity of 1,000 feet per second and 500 foot-pounds of energy. You can compare that with a 45-millimeter automatic handgun, which is legal to harvest a deer in Texas or pronghorn or sheep or whatever else. Shooting a 200-grain bullet has about the same speed, velocity there, 900 feet per second, and a little bit less muzzle energy at 360 foot-pounds. And then you can compare that to a 17 Hornet, which is also a legal firearm to take big game in Texas, which has a very small bullet, 20-grain bullet, shoots 3,650 feet per second, so traveling very fast, and has about 592 foot-pounds of energy. And so these air rifles are comparable to some of our other legal means of take in Texas and are very capable of harvesting big game or deer. And Ellis Powell and myself had the opportunity to demo a couple of big bore air rifles, a 45 caliber and a 308 caliber, a couple of weeks ago. We were able to, as we were doing that research, able to use those to harvest three white-tailed deer spikes, and very effective means of take for those white-tailed deer. So staff see no rationale not to allow big bore air rifles and air bows for the harvest of big game in Texas, provided the commission would like us to proceed with this proposal in January. If staff were to bring this proposal forward, we would prohibit the use of air rifles and air bows during archery and muzzleloader seasons and limit take to alligator, white-tailed deer, mule deer, pronghorn, bighorn sheep, and javelina. Additionally, staff would consider requiring minimum caliber requirements of 30 caliber and larger, and specify that air rifles, air bows must be charged from an external high-pressure income power source, such as a tank or a compressor or a hand pump, and that the arrows used for air bows would follow similar standards that we have for archery equipment that require broadheads to have a 7/8 inch width edge upon impact and a minimum of 2 cutting edges. And so that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
I've got one question for you. Have we thought about having a minimum muzzle energy requirement? I realize currently it's only you can't use rimfire, but I'm surprised that you could hunt with a automatic that only generated 360 foot-pounds of energy for big game.
There's some, I mean, quite frankly, you can hunt with a 32 Smith & Wesson handgun, which has 87 foot-pounds of energy. So, and we don't, I'll have to ask Ellis to come up here in a minute. He would know more. But I will tell you this, you can get into regulating muzzle energy and velocity, but you can still, we don't regulate how far somebody shoots or require they take a skills test to be able to accurately take an animal. But Ellis, I'll let you answer the
Regulating the foot pounds, it specifically foot pounds would be
right.
Would be difficult. It would all equate back to the formula on how you get there with the size, the caliber of the bullet that we would allow, the grain of the actual bullet itself. So it would be. I hadn't even thought through how. I don't know how we would do that just yet. I'd have to put some thought into that if we were talking about regulating foot pounds.
It just troubles me that you could go deer hunting with a 87 foot-pound muzzle energy weapon. I hadn't thought about it until you made your presentation. But
it's not something, Commissioner. It's not something that our wardens see. In my career, I've never seen that. I have seen some outlaw hunters poach with small pistols or something, but your recreational hunter, you just don't see that.
This may be something we want to look at. I realize that's a big task, but we might want to think about that.
Be glad to address it.
I got a question. Commissioner Scott.
Two real quick. So one, you're satisfied that 30 caliber is big enough to handle it. I do know that, like you're 17, I've got one that, if you shoot the center fire, it is a 3650, and you can kill most anything with that. But if y'all are comfortable with a 30 caliber, you know, that we bow to y'all's stuff on that. One question I was asked about this issue, and I did not know the answer. Do you go through the same things to buy one of these kind of air guns or air bows that you go through to buy a 243? You don't have to do all the registration and stuff on these, do you?
No, sir. These, by definition, are not considered a firearm, but as Alan said, under federal law or state law, there's no restriction as far as a prohibited person or background check or anything like that.
I didn't think there was. I just wanted to make sure. What this accomplishes is not having to buy and go through the ridiculous amount of paperwork and time it takes to get a suppressor is basically what it accomplishes, which is not necessarily bad. I'm just stating a fact.
I will tell you, when Ellis and I were hunting with these, just as part of the research, they're not exactly quiet. I mean, they're fairly noisy. You don't have to wear ear protection, but there's definitely a crack. It's enough to scare a deer off out of the field. And I harvested one of the buck or two bucks with a 308 caliber, and Ellis used a 45 caliber, and so all deer one shot, very quick, humane take, and so they're effective.
Yeah, that's. I'm good with that.
Any other questions?
So, if there's someone that doesn't have the authority to purchase a firearm because of previous felonies and or other problems,
they can buy an air gun.
They can buy one of these. Can they get a hunting license with a previous felony?
You might have to ask.
Yes,
him,
sir.
But I think he He has to, if he's got a clear record, he can get a hunting license, right?
Yes, sir, unless there's some court-specific restriction that says we're going to take your hunting license for certain offenses, they do that. But in general, a felony, they can still go hunting. They can use other means, archery, crossbow, muzzle loaders. And now, if this were passed, they could use these. It would not stop somebody from hunting. A felony necessarily doesn't stop them from hunting. They can purchase a hunting license.
Law enforcement.
Are we okay with that?
Well, doesn't matter. They can get it anyway. They can buy their gun at any time.
I know, but are we okay with the consequences of them going out and harvesting animals with it? It's just something I'd like to think about. I'm not suggesting we do. We don't have to make a decision now, but I think it's something we ought to at least think all the way through to make sure we do maybe what we can to at least address that issue.
Carter, you make a note of that?
Yeah, I did. And just as a reminder, ultimately, we are going to be going out for public comment in January if you authorize us to go forward with rules, and so we can get feedback on that issue and others. We can certainly talk to our colleagues from other states that probably have contemplated this issue as well and see what kind of feedback we get there.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll move on to work session item number 8, grant of conservation easement, Stevens County, approximately 33 acres at Palo Pinto Mountain State Park. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This first item I'm bringing to you is in response to a request from Palo Pinto County Municipal Water District Number 1 that we place a conservation easement on a small area of Palo Pinto Mountains State Park in Stevens County, in the Stevens County portion of the park, which is partly in Stevens and partly in Palo Pinto County in north central Texas. That is a park that's not open to the public yet, but we are wrapping up that public use plan. It's a spectacular piece of property, a little over 4,000 acres, only about 70 miles west of Fort Worth. Excellent, excellent habitat. We've acquired that property over the last few years as a result of having sold property at a 400-acre tract in Fort Worth that we didn't feel was nearly as suitable for a state park. The property includes a 90-acre lake. It includes 4 miles of the North Creek of Palo Pinto, North Fork of Palo Pinto Creek. And again, just a really spectacular property, and I know we're all very, very much looking forward to being able to open that to the public. You can see the shape of the property here. You can also tell from this map that it straddles local geological formation known as Palo Pinto Mountain State Park, about 400 feet of relief in those hills in that park. We've been working with the Water District for several years now. Their primary source of water, their only source of water, is Palo Pinto Lake. They provide water to mineral wells and surrounding communities out of that lake. Droughts in recent years have caused them to be concerned about the capacity of that lake to continue providing that water as those communities grow. And their response is that they propose to build a second dam immediately downstream, essentially double the capacity of Palo Pinto Lake by adding a body of water that would be called a Turkey Creek, Turkey Peak Lake. But in the process, of course, they are losing some Palo Pinto Creek. And through Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, they're required to mitigate for those impacts. In 2014, we had a 450-acre tract of land that we were going to add, or we still propose to add, to the state park under option contract. It included about 1.1 miles of the North Fork of Palo Pinto Creek. The district approached us through their consultants and requested that we assign that option to purchase to the district. The district, in turn, would extract the credits they needed from that segment of the creek, would place a conservation easement on that segment of the creek, and then would sell the entire 450-acre tract back to Texas Parks and Wildlife, at about a third of what they paid for it. The commission agreed to that, the staff agreed to that, and we're operating under that agreement currently. In the meantime, we've also worked with the district on doing stream characterizations for other reaches of the creek inside the park. We've worked together on access issues and management issues. When it came right down to issuing that permit, the Corps of Engineers determined that they didn't quite have enough credit for the permit they need to build that dam and impound that body of water. So the district returned to us and has been working with us on putting a conservation easement on another reach of the creek that is already inside the state park. It's about a 1.8-mile reach of the state park. The advantage of this arrangement to us is that they would restore that reach of creek. They would remove exotic species. They would plant native species. And they would undertake any fire or any other management tools that would be required for them to reach their success criteria along that creek. And that plan is fully consistent with the resource management plan developed for the park, would save the Parks Division the money that we would have otherwise spent to do that exotic species control, to do those plantings, and to restore that reach of creek. Our estimate is probably that's a $50,000 to $100,000 savings to undertake that restoration work. Also, we very carefully designed that conservation easement in such a way that it would not interfere with any of our park development plans. There are gaps in that conservation easement where we intend to put trails or bridges across the creek. There are provisions in that conservation easement that would allow the public to still have full access to that creek for fishing or picnicking and so forth. So we've worked to make sure that conservation easement would not interfere with our public use plan. You can see from this map where that reach of the creek is. It's a narrow corridor. I believe that's about 150 feet wide on average, just again to protect the creek itself and the banks of the creek immediately adjacent to the creek. We did encourage the district to look at options other than the state park, and although they located a couple of stream segments that probably would have qualified with the Corps of Engineers, they were on private property. Their concern, and quite frankly our concern, is that if you only protect 150-foot-wide corridor and you have overgrazing occurring, or you have crop agriculture occurring, or you have subdivision development occurring that close to that creek, you're still going to have impacts that are going to compromise fish and wildlife values by undertaking this work and protecting this creek inside the state park. Then, of course, we can control that adjacent development and ensure that the gain in fish and wildlife values that result from that permit and from that work that's done will last in perpetuity. We received no public comments on this proposal, and with that, the staff does recommend that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
There are no further. I'm sorry. You have a question, Commissioner Latimer?
So, to go back to the map where the easement is, the 450 acres that they are going to give us at a reduced price, is that block on top?
No, ma'am. It's not shown. It's immediately
it's
east.
Shown.
It's immediately east of that block on top.
Okay, so
it is north of the park.
So this is already in the park, that piece. So it's an additional piece that would adjoin that?
Yes, ma'am, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? There's no further discussion. I will place the grant of conservation easement Stevens County on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. We'll move on to work session item number 9, grant of conservation easement Blanco County, approximately 164 acres of Pernales Falls State Park. Mr. Hollingsworth.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is a follow-up to an action that you took and authorized earlier this year to acquire land adjacent to Pernalis Falls State Park, overlooking the park's namesake falls. That is in Blanco County, not very far west of Austin, about 30 miles west of Austin. Spectacular park. You heard it mentioned earlier today that that's one of those parks where we've had to impose some visitation limitations during peak times of the year because of how popular that park is. About 215,000 visitors in recent years. And as you recall from earlier in the year, you did authorize us to acquire a critical tract of land overlooking those falls from a willing landowner. We are still, just in the interest of full disclosure, we're still working on the details of that transaction. But one of those details is that the landowner wants to make sure that land does stay in conservation for state park purposes in perpetuity. It is a bargain sale, and he and his attorney feel that placing a conservation easement on top of that acquisition would just help ensure that the property never leaves the state park system. The conservation easement would be held by the Texas Land Conservancy, who already holds an easement on about 450 acres of that man's ranch, of the seller's ranch. It would be a simple conservation easement that would simply prevent any subdivision or overdevelopment of that property. It would fully allow public access, trails, modest recreational development, all those uses that we would have planned for the property anyway. And staff does believe that having a conservation easement on the property is fully consistent with the mission of the department and the State Parks Division. We did receive one comment this morning from someone who just simply made the statement that there's already enough development in Pernalis Falls State Park and that our focus should be on maintaining the facilities we already have in the state park. I think he's simply arguing that if we add land, we should not add land and overdevelop it. With that, the staff recommends the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. The commission adopts the resolution attached as Exhibit A, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Just a quick comment. Having looked at this and everything, I was most supportive when we did it. We've found a person that truly believes in preserving the natural beauty of this whole area that we owe a debt of gratitude to. And to do this conservation easement, to me, is a no-brainer.
Any other comments? There's no further discussion. I will place the grant of conservation easement Blanco County on the Thursday Commission meeting for public comment and action. Work session item number 10, grant of waterline easement Walker County, approximately a tenth of an acre at Huntsville State Park. Mr. Trey Vick.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Trey Vick, and today I am asking for a request of easement of approximately a tenth of an acre at Huntsville State Park in Walker County. Huntsville State Park sits about 6 miles south of Huntsville. It's about 2,000 acres. It's located deep in the Piney Woods. Park staff has been approached by the city of Huntsville for an easement to cross a 40-foot strip of land the department purchased back in 2008 to bring city utilities down to the park. This easement's going to be approximately 40 by 40, and it's to improve their water system. The requested location is about 3/4 mile from the main part of the park and is not used by the public. This strip of land was used to bring water and sewer into the park, so it's been disturbed and cleared at one time. Well, in exchange for this easement, the developer of the land surrounding the park has agreed to an enforceable deed restriction of a 25-foot buffer to protect the perimeter of the park. It's about 5.2 miles of perimeter. The deed restriction will run concurrently with the term of the waterline easement. The city of Huntsville anticipates needing more of that 40-foot stretch in the near future, so we're currently working with the city and the adjacent landowner of a possible fee simple swap of about a half acre for almost 16 acres of deed restricted buffer. So in addition to the proposed resolution authorizing a term easement, we're requesting permission to begin the public notice and input process for the exchange outlined above, and we anticipate coming back in January for action on that swap. There's a map. You can see the approximate location, and that little finger that goes up, there's a 40-foot strip that I mentioned. And it's about three-quarters of a mile away from the park. There's a close-up of it. The city's existing water line comes through the subdivision to the north of the park called Elkins Lake, and that's where they're looking to tie into their current water line. And here's just an illustration showing the 25-foot buffer around the perimeter of the park that we're working on is for the exchange. We've received no comments on this transaction, and if there's no questions, the staff recommends the commission adopt the resolution attached as Exhibit A.
Any questions? No further discussion. We'll place the grant of waterline easement in Walker County on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Work session item number 11, update on regulatory litigation, red snapper, oysters, and chronic wasting disease, regulatory authority, ownership of deer. These items will be held in executive session. At this time, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, including advice regarding pending or contemplated litigation. We will now recess for executive session.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have a little housekeeping to do here before we start the meeting. We're reconvening the regular session of the work session on November 1st, 2017 at 2:12 p.m. Work session item number 11. We went through an executive session. This commission has now completed its work session business, and I declare us adjourned. Now, good afternoon, everyone. Before we start official business, I'd like to just personally say how appreciative I am of the opportunity to be here. Luskin is known for his love of the outdoors, hunting and fishing. We were very fortunate yesterday afternoon to have a tour of Boggy Slough, and it was absolutely fascinating, and I can't wait to come back in a couple of years and see all the fruits of the effort that's been put into managing it. We get out of Austin not often enough, and it's a real pleasure to be here to see and hear what things concern people of East Texas. And they have a long tradition of hunting and fishing. I mentioned this morning that at one point, Lufkin had the highest per capita ratio of hunting and fishing licenses to population of any city in Texas. So thank you, and we're glad to be here. And with that, I'll start the meeting. Call to order November 1st, 2017. Now, must be 2:14. Mr. Smith, I think you have a something to say?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as Open Meetings Act. Mr. Chairman, I'd like for that this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I just want to join all of you in welcoming everybody to this regional public hearing. Obviously, we have a big footprint in East Texas, as the Chairman alluded to, on the fisheries, the wildlife, the law enforcement, and the state park side. We know that this part of the state is filled with people who care about the outdoors, their outdoors, and we're proud to be your partner in helping to steward it. This is an opportunity, really, for us to hear from y'all. And we came here very, very specifically because of the importance of this region to Texas as a whole and a chance for us to hear what's on your mind about the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And that's probably a pretty good segue just into a little bit of the housekeeping in terms of how we're going to conduct the regional public hearing today. Hopefully all of you who want to have a chance to address the commission have signed up outside at the appropriate time. The chairman is going to call you forward by name, have a chance to come to the podium. I would simply ask that you state your name and where you're from, and whether that's Evadale or Lufkin, tell us what part of East Texas you're from, and then everybody will have 2 minutes to address the commission on any topic of interest to you. And so, again, we're excited to be here. We appreciate you all taking time out of your afternoon to share your sentiments about the work that we do with all of you to help steward your fish and wildlife and parks. And so thanks for the chance to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. First, I'd like to start with a couple of special guests. First one is Mayor Brown. Would you please step forward? Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for your kind words. We are thrilled to death that you have come to Lufkin, Texas, to have this open hearing. We are thrilled to death that you took time to do so, and don't wait 2 years. Come on back. We are ready for you. Executive Director Smith, thank you so much for what you do for the state of Texas. We are thrilled to death. And I noticed, Moran,
yeah,
that you're from Houston. What I want you to do when you go to bed tonight is remember that you spent the day in Lufkin, Texas, where the Thundering 13 won the Little League World Series. And I pray with an open heart that you go home tonight with a World Series. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I understand there's going to be a TV in the corner someplace this evening. Next is Senator Nichols. I'd love to hear from Senator Nichols. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Welcome. The mayor just welcomed you to the city. I want to welcome you to East Texas, Senate District 3. We've got 19 counties. We have more river authorities, I think six river authorities here in East Texas, and we've got game, fish, forest. That's beautiful. And it's Texas Parks and Wildlife is a very important part of that. Your rules, your regulations, your enforcement are all vital. We appreciate the fact that you did take the time to come to East Texas and on other occasions come to other parts of the state. I would encourage the commission to set up as a routine basis going out. We were talking about that earlier. Some of the other agencies do that. And it gives people an opportunity around the state to visit, to be heard, that otherwise would not go to Austin have the meeting. So we very much appreciate the work that you and the people of the department do for our state. And so thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Ashby, welcome to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Welcome to God's country. We're delighted to have you here in Lufkin, Angelina County, East Texas, the heart of House District 57 that I'm blessed to represent. I just want to say publicly how much I appreciate all that you do as public servants, serving on the Parks and Wildlife Commission. I know from time to time it can seem like a thankless job, But I want you to know the people of East Texas appreciate the role that you have because we're equally passionate about our outdoors, about our state parks, about our fisheries. And I'm just delighted to have you in this part of the state where we take our relationship that we have with you very seriously. And we try to be, along with you, good stewards of those state parks and wildlife management areas in this area. And also I want to publicly thank our law enforcement, our game wardens that are out there serving us on the front lines. Many times we don't get a chance to publicly thank them for what they do for the Texas Parks and Wildlife and the folks that are behind me here that are out there in these woods this time of year getting ready for opening weekend of deer season. But we appreciate the role they play in keeping us safe and making sure that we're adhering to the rules and regulations that you put before us. And so it's just an honor to have you here. And I join with Senator Nichols in echoing what he said, as well as the mayor. We'd love to have you back. Y'all are welcome here anytime. And certainly on behalf of this area of the state, we want to warmly welcome you to East Texas. And we wish you best for a productive meeting while you're here in the area. So thank you.
Thank you and Senator Nichols for all the support you've given the department. It really makes a difference, and it is deeply appreciated. So, and we're glad to be here. And with that, I'll call those that have signed up to speak. You have 2 minutes, and I'd like to, I'm going to read two names, and with the second person, I think it's appropriate to ask them to be on deck. So. The first is David Yates, and second is Dalton Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is David Yates. I work for Texas Wildlife Association. It's a treat to be here to talk about something fun, and that's the Texas Youth Hunting Program. As you know, it's an official partnership program with TWA and Parks and Wildlife. It was in the program... since its inception in 96, has hosted about 3,000 hunts, taken about 23,000 young Texans, mostly on their first hunt across the state of Texas. Most of that's been on private land. We've got a core of volunteers of about 17,000. We have access to about 600 landowners' properties around the state. And we're on a clip this year to run about 225 hunts for about 1,500 kids. And again, most of those are inner city youth, and they're almost all first-time hunters, so it's a deeply impactful program. The partnership is both formal and informal. There's MOUs and agreements and volunteer hour tracking and structure and all that, but the informal part of it is so much more important. We have so much support from the Parks and Wildlife staff from all over the state. But here close to home, Penny Wilkerson over in Cass County in the Wildlife Division, Robert Barker in North Toledo Bend and Allison Bayou, WMAs, and then all the way out to John Apgar out in the Trans-Pecos, putting together volunteer trainings for game wardens to host hunts. So it's just been a tremendous success. That's demonstrated in the template being exported to five other states and Mexico, most recently Tennessee. So Texas leads the way, again, on the youth hunting front. I just want to say thank you very much for the support. It means a lot. The credibility that the department lends with the official partnership moves mountains with landowners. The department's been providing access to land for hosting hunts. And there's nobody that can speak better about the program than one of its participants. Mr. Dalton Perry next to me, or coming up next, is a participant, and I look forward to hearing his words. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Perry?
Good afternoon. My name is Dalton Perry.
On deck is Carl Ray Polk.
And I was recently chosen to go on a youth hunt in South Texas. And some friends of ours that went with us, they had never been on a hunt before. And they got to learn a lot about conservation, and I think that's important because sometime we're going to be the ones voting for whether it's right to hunt or not. And just wanted to thank y'all.
Thank you. And next will be Gerald Reichel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Director Carter, my thunder was stolen. I think it's pretty evident by the comments from the mayor and Senator Nichols and Representative Ashby. Your being here in Angelina County is a big deal, and we appreciate you taking out the time in your schedules to do so. Secondly, I'm an advocate for the program that David and the young man just spoke about. Many of these attending today, I'll forget names, so I won't go through them specifically, here, both here in East Texas and at their places in other parts of the state, have been advocates for that program. I was a part of one of them a week ago. Our local game wardens came out and take part in those, and it is a fantastic experience for those young kiddos that have not had the chance to be exposed to the outdoors. So, again, kind of took my thunder with David there, but we're appreciative that you're here. My last comment would be about your staff, Mr. Chairman. It starts from the top, the leadership that your director imposes on his staff all over the state, but specifically to our favorite part of East Texas, whether it's our biologists, whether it's our wardens. I would remind you, these guys, I don't have to tell you this, they work very hard. They represent landowners, and I was just reading an article the other day that they're my game wardens. So we commend you for your work there. Thanks for being here. We hope to come back. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Gerald Reichel and Vernon Barbe is on deck.
My name is Gerald Reichel from Grapeland, Texas, not Grapevine. Good afternoon. We want to state public target ranges with access as outlined in a document provided to you earlier. In the 1930s, sportsmen volunteered for an 11% excise tax on guns, ammunition, and more recently on archery equipment. This tax is called Pittman-Robertson or PR tax. That tax money goes to the federal government, then back to the states, based basically on the number of licensed hunters in that state. Texas is number one. We receive more money than any other state. Last year, the Texas Wildlife Department received $32.14 million. This money goes to the Wildlife Department, not the general fund. It took an act of Congress in the year 2000 to slow this mismanagement of PR funds. That act passed 423-2. It further defines how our tax money is to be spent. Because we volunteered for this tax, we have a say in how this money is to be spent. One of the items we've approved is target ranges. So we contacted the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and asked, where is our nearest Texas target range? The TPWD answer, we don't have any. When asked, what have you done with the $462.59 million we have already given to you, their response, the portion that applies to target ranges we give to private companies. Two examples, Shady Oaks Gun Range in Cedar Park, just north of Austin, was given $668,646. If you want to shoot at this range, the fee is $20 an hour. Or the Sportsman Shooting Center in Grapevine, that private business was given $2 million. That's right, $2 million by TPWD. If you want to shoot there, it will cost you $50 an hour. Neither of these rangers meets our definition of a public shooting range. We want state target ranges. We want state target ranges. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
My name is Byron Barbe. I'm president of the Sabine County Landowners Leaseholders Association. We are a 17-year-old organization with approximately 400 members, and we are all live and or hunt here in Deep East Texas. I'm also a past board member of OGT. A couple of things I'd like to compliment you on your staff, the biologists that work this region. They have done countless educational seminars and presentations for our organization over the last 17 years, and the men and women that work down there have been exemplary in their help and support of what we do. Also on that note, the law enforcement, your wardens here, I don't think we could have gotten our feet on the ground and got going 17 years ago if it was not for the support and backup that these guys and gals have provided. They are always there when they're needed, and they are what protects our resources. Thank you for having all these people out there. The issues I wanted to talk to you about, one, East Texas has a known high poacher region of the state, would be put it mildly, maybe. We have empty warden slots in every county around me, including the one I'm in. I understand there are budgetary issues, but in the future, we sure hope that we can get assignments in our area to fill the rest of our slots. Two things that the commission is responsible for that our organization is 100% behind, and I want to pat you on the back and tell you that. One is your management and oversight of high-fence deer operations. All of us are in constant fear that CWD is going to get out. Once it's out, you can't put it back in the bag. So thank you for that management level. The other thing that we are very much in support of is the 13-inch antler restriction. It has done immense good here in East Texas. And to the member, I believe all of us are behind you on that. Thank you very much for coming east of the Trinity River.
Thanks for your comments. Next, we have Richard Landers and Julie Shackelford.
My name is Richard Landers. I'm from Pollock, Texas, which is north of Lufkin, about 12 miles. I'd like to talk about youth hunting. I think it's a great program. I know recruitment's a problem. And I can tell you from my own experience with my own son, I started him with me when he was 5, and I helped him kill about 8 deer. But then when it's 13, and I'm not against the 13-inch rule, okay, for adults. But when the 13-inch rule was come into place, after about 2 years, he quit hunting because he got tired of watching deer walk by. And he couldn't shoot them. This past weekend, I took my great nephew on a youth hunt at Allison, and there they allow youth to kill whatever they want. Bill Adams, who's over Allison, does a good job there, and all the staff. And because of it, my nephew killed his first deer, and we weren't afraid whether it was legal or not, or whether we broke the law. When a buck walked, it ended up being would have been legal. But then when the buck walked out, I had no issues with worrying about what it was or how big it was. And he made a good shot, and I was proud of it. But my deal is, what I would like to see the commissions do is come up with a plan to maybe find a way to let youth on their license maybe have one buck tag, and they can fill it however they want. That's what I'd like to see happen.
Yes, something to think about. And after Julie is Will Kirkpatrick.
Good afternoon. Welcome to East Texas. I'm Julie Shackelford. I am from Nacogdoches, and I am a former Texas Parks and Wildlife Department employee. I currently work for the Conservation Fund, where I've been for about 15 years. We're a national nonprofit organization dedicated to conserving land and water, and we have worked with the department on many land conservation projects over the last few years, including Powderhorn Ranch, Village Creek, Natural Resource Damage Assessment Projects, and now the Herculean efforts of the staff to work on BP-related acquisitions. And I just want to give a couple shout-outs. Y'all have been incredibly terrific to work with as partners, and the common thread through all the projects that I have just listed has been your land conservation department, and in particular, Ted Hollingsworth, who is just the consummate, efficient, and professional partner, and he's just a real treat to work with. A couple other points I wanted to just bring up is your nature tourism staff has done a really incredible job of bringing to light unique programs like the birding trails, the paddling trails. I think it's brought a lot of attention, in particular to East Texas, positive attention, because this is an area where I think we can really capitalize and bring additional tourists to. Shelley Plant has been a fabulous person to work with on the Parks and Wildlife staff. And lastly, I just want to give a shout out to the biologists who are out there who have really adopted an ecosystem habitat approach as opposed to a single species approach. And I think that's going to serve the land and serve our citizens well as we go forward in the future. And just thank you for being a terrific partner.
Thank you. Adrian Van Dellen and Richard Donovan.
My name is Will Kirkpatrick. I live on Sam Rayburn Reservoir. So recently I gave Director Smith one of Bassmaster Tournament Organization's last 100 copies of the 44-page booklet, Keeping Bass Alive. They will not reprint these due to the inability to find a sponsor to pay for the printing cost. I was asked by BASS to assist in this booklet due to my involvement and knowledge on the issue. Recently, there was a for-profit Major League Fishing Television tournament involving Bassmaster Elite Pro Anglers held on Lake Nacogdoches this spring. During TV viewing of that event, I had an unobstructed view of six pro anglers landing 77 pre-spawn bass, of which 48 were grasped around the body with dry hands twice. This method of handling violates every detailed catch and release study done, including page four of the Keeping Bass Alive booklet. Having spent hundreds of hours with accredited biologists on the water in my fishing school, TPWD events, and detailed correspondence both written, summarize it, dry hands kill fish. In a recent phone conversation with a TPWD member, it was explained that although this isn't the best method, it kills fewer fish than the other methods. Our TPWD outdoor regulation booklet on page 15, and I gave everything I've got here to Director Smith. Waste of game deals with this very issue. It's illegal and it's a Class C felony, misdemeanor. TPWD biologists did one of the first and most lengthy bass tournament mortality studies involving a month-long study of two tournaments documenting a death rate of 25 and 31% of bass. These bass were from a Bassmasters tournament, Don't Kill Your Catch, and a Bass Federation tournament held on Toledo Bend. It was recommended by the biologists, and I'll read this after we're done, since the Senator Nichols and Representative Ashby are in the office. Your press release of September 21st also states that you will loan weight scale kits to tournament organizers throughout Texas, and if tournament demands grow, you may look into having more scales available at no cost. I'm assuming you plan on using our money to fund these purchases to be used by for-profit bass tournament organizations, although there is no fee in place to use our state's water by for-profit events without any funding. Recreation landers must continue to support TPWD and all their associated costs. You will also continue to improperly spend our funds, including a $43 million hatchery that started out when I first became involved in it at $13.5 million. You continue to draw in over $9 million annually from our stamp fee that was set up for 10 years. And it was set up here by our Todd Staples, who was Mr. Nichols' predecessor. And he set it up for 10 years. I've talked to him in his office. I talked to Bob Cook. Mr. Cook told me, standing about 10 foot away, Will, it's written in stone. At the end of 10-year period, this fee is gone. Well, it was supposed to end in August 31st of 14, and this is November the 1st of 17, and we're still paying it. The hatchery's done. They're going to use this money probably for something else. I recently asked Director Smith about the expenditures of 70 employees they used for bass and Toyota events. It totaled out those 70 employees. I asked him what it cost us to have them, because it is our money. For $720, they'll tell me how they spent our money. With that, I'd like to read you your biologist's statement. Organizations holding tournaments for profit, such as the ones monitored in this study, can make a significant contribution to the largemouth bass management efforts of state conservation agencies throughout a tournament permit purchase. In my opinion, states should require such charges for these tournaments, and the money should be earmarked for bass research, largemouth bass research and management programs. Based on Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's pollution mitigation policy, which charges $2.25 for 12-inch bass. This was done before the 14-inch limit came in. There would be a $2.25 fee, which would account for approximately $2,000 for the 900 fish that are killed in the catch and release program. If you have any questions, we have more information. But thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkpatrick. All right, next is Adrian Van Dellen, Richard Donovan, and Brenda Job. Right?
Am I out of place? I'm Richard Donovan. Am I out of line?
Welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by voicing my thanks to, like the rest of the people here, for having invoked in East Texas. We kind of feel like sometimes that we're maybe forgotten about behind the pine curtain in here sometimes. I'd like to speak to you about paddling trails. Thank you so very much for the beautiful paddling trails that you've already established on our East Texas rivers. We think that it does a good bit to bring people to East Texas. And along that line, I'd like to speak about establishing a series of paddling trails from Anderson Crossing on the Neches River down to Highway 59. If we could get that done, that would be 47.7 contiguous miles of paddling trails on Neches River. There are some 14 million people living within easy day's driving of Lufkin, Texas. I think that if that 47.7 contiguous miles of paddling trail were available, I think we would get a lot of visitors to East Texas and help our economy here that has suffered so much from recent economic losses recently. To do this, I think that's going to take Texas Parks and Wildlife, the U.S. Forest Service, Angelina County, and Trinity County working through some kind of relationship to get all of this done. I'm not here to try to tell you how to do your job because I'm certainly not intelligent enough to do that. But I do wish that somebody would put their shoulder to the wheel and try to help get this done because it would mean so much to East Texas. It would mean so much to the youth that could come here and enjoy themselves and have a lot of benefits that I can't even stand here and enumerate today. Thank you so very much for your patience.
Well, thanks for your input.
Richard Donovan is a hard act to follow. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, and Director Smith, thank you for this opportunity to briefly speak to you. I'm Adrian Van Dellen. I live in Woodville and chairman of the Texas Black Bear Alliance. The Alliance has a mission seeking restoration of a black bear in suitable rural habitat in its historical range, and through partnerships in education, research, and habitat management, we hope to accomplish our mission. Just imagine seeing resident black bears occupying prime bear habitat in East Texas. We have 1 million acres of prime bear habitat in Texas, and there's not a breeding population in there. Our neighboring states have done well on an active approach in restoration and have demonstrated remarkable success in peaceful coexistence with the black bear. However, black bear conservation and management in Texas has been and continues to be a passive one. This is working very well in West Texas, but in East Texas, a passive conservation and management plan holds little, if any, promise in restoring black bear to our part of the state. This sporadic, temporary reappearance of a keystone species, primarily in northeast Texas, constitutes nearly all males. The last female was sighted 6 years ago. Wandering bears just don't stay in East Texas. We need a restoration action plan to get a breeding population of black bear back into East Texas. And a restoration action plan for the black bear
that is applicable to East Texas. This has been written and successfully implemented for the last 25 years, and it was written in the early 90s when the Black Bear Conservation Committee was organized and the Louisiana Black Bear was listed under the Endangered Species Act. That plan continues to unfold in Louisiana and could, and we suggest, should include East Texas. So if I may be so bold to suggest that Texas Parks and Wildlife should start joint discussions between Texas and Louisiana officials, exploring pertinent resources and relevant strategies for East Texas Black Bear Restoration Action Plan. We of the Texas Black Bear Alliance would welcome and be delighted to be part of such discussions. Thank you very much. You are appreciated. Appreciate being here.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your input. You're going to pass your time? All right. Thank you. Kent Evans and Robert Potts.
Good afternoon. I am Kent Evans, and my remarks are directed today in support of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the work you've been doing to assist the restoration of the longleaf pine fire ecosystem to its historic range in East Texas. Your agency has been a vital part of the work for many years. In 2010, your department helped me and others forge a partnership, now known as the Texas Longleaf Task Force, and it's led by a steering committee of 14 conservation organizations, of which you're a part, and roughly 300 stakeholders of landowners, agencies, and others here in East Texas. Restoration of the upland native forest ecosystems in East Texas, longleaf and shortleaf being the most scarce of those, they're disappearing components of the native forest, and they require regular use of prescribed fire. So our team, our team together, these 14 organizations, they've been helping to secure grants and provide cost-share monies through Texas A&M Forest Service to help landowners offset the cost of those burns. So your department has provided technical guidance to landowners, and you've been standing alongside in a limited way, but helping landowners to burn their own land. It's really important. Now, I participated in public and private partnerships in four states for over 30 years as a U.S. Forest Service person. And I want you to know, I recognize what you're doing here in East Texas. Extremely important. And the use of prescribed fire, and I got Smokey Bear here on my collar, it's not only improving wildlife habitat, but each acre that you burn reduces the risk of catastrophic wildfire, which we had in 2011, and your acres burned and your people helping is helping to reduce that risk. So please keep doing it. And also, as a person that plays on the beaches and bays of Matagorda, see the yellow light, and Brazoria County, the clean water that flows out of East Texas hits our bays. And when it gets there, I need you all to do everything you can to protect those shallow water oyster reefs from overharvest and degradation. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Mr. Potts and then Mr. Dickerson.
Good afternoon. My name is Rob Potts. I'm representing the U.S. Forest Service, National Forests and Grasslands in Texas, here in Lufkin, Texas. I want to express my appreciation and thank you to the department for invaluable contributions they make to habitat restoration for the betterment of game and non-game species, including work we're doing in longleaf pine, shortleaf pine, and blackland prairie. I also want to express my appreciation for contributions the department is making to our response to various disasters in East Texas, whether it's drought or flooding or straight-lined wind events. Also want to express appreciation for contributions the department has made, especially in times of declining budgets, to budgeting and accounting systems and auditing systems to ensure that we are being good stewards of the financial resources that that we're blessed with. Again, we thank you for being here, and thank you so much for the partnership. We just simply could not complete our mission at the Forest Service without your partnership. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dickerson? Dennis Dickerson? Gordon Henley.
I got a couple of questions, I guess. You know, kind of, if we are so important to you guys, how come it took y'all so long to get here? You know, we've been here for a long time, and we've enjoyed the fine woods around here, and I don't know where some of these people are getting their information on the 13-inch rule, but the people I talk to, my friends and fellow hunters and people like that, family, they're not in favor of it. I get about 1 out of 10 that favors the 13-inch rule. And I guess my question would be, why do we have a 13-inch rule? And I haven't understood that yet. But I'd like to, where do we go to get answers? Are we at the right place? And I'd like to know. I've attended several meetings in the past, and I haven't found out anything yet.
You know, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask, we've got the head of our wildlife division here and the head of our big game program, Mitch Lockwood and Clayton Wolf, and they're sitting right here. And if you take a little time after the meeting to visit with them, I'd love for them to have a chance to explain the basis for the rules and share a little bit about its history and also what we're accomplishing.
I understand the rules, but I don't understand the why.
And I'd love for them to explain the why.
All right.
Yeah. So let me ask them to raise their hands in the audience. And so that's Mr. Wolf and Mr. Lockwood, and we'll be happy to make time to visit with you.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. Yeah. Yeah.
We'll get you your answers. Thank you. Gordon Henley, thank you. And Terry Tate is on deck.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Director Smith, I'll welcome to you to East Texas, too. I'm Gordon Henley. I'm Director of the Allen Trout Zoo here in Lufkin. And I've had numerous relationships with Parks and Wildlife during my tenure here. And I want to commend you on all of the things that the relationships we've had. I'm here in particular to talk about the Louisiana Pine Snake Program. That's the rarest snake in the United States. And any time that we have to work with Parks and Wildlife in our permit session for that snake, we get immediate cooperation, and it's made the program work. What we're doing is breeding them in captivity and releasing them in suitable habitat in the wild, and right now it's in Louisiana. So we deal with transportation of the snake through Texas and through Louisiana, and we bring in large numbers. We consolidated the population this year, which was, we got a hold of the permit office, and within an afternoon our permit was modified to allow that activity. And bringing back a snake, I mean, everybody's talking about deer and bears, and I'm here to tell you about a snake, and it's wonderful to be able to get that kind of support and to know that we're making a positive effort to keep that snake alive in the wild, and it's a large part due to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to thank you and the council members for your serious consideration of allowing big bore air guns to take game animals in the state of Texas. And I think it may be on the agenda this year. And I certainly do appreciate you looking at it. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Henderson. Pass. Scott Hall. And on deck is Alan Temple.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for being here in East Texas. And Commissioners Carter, always good to see you. I am Scott Hall. I'm the General Manager for the Lower Neches Valley Authority. And I just want to thank you and make sure you as commissioners are aware of the good work that we've been doing together on Sam Raven Reservoir in Lake VA Steinhagen. About a decade ago, LMVA partnered with the Corps of Engineers and Texas Parks and Wildlife to address invasive aquatic vegetation issues, mainly on VA Steinhagen. As time has progressed, that has shifted us to a focus on Sam Raven, and about 2 years ago, we had a big raft of giant salvinia come out in the north end of the lake. It was toward the end of the year, LNDA and the Corps were out of funding that year, and Parks and Wildlife came through in a big way, and we got that addressed. In the last 12 months, our partnership has taken care of 5,000 acres of lake surface that was covered with giant sunfish. It has been a tremendous success story. Appreciate Senator Nichols and his contribution to make sure you got the funding from the state to keep that up. I hope you will continue to support those efforts. The additional funding has allowed for wintertime treatments that really make a dent, and this year we feel like we've turned a big corner on that project. So thank you for your consideration on that, and I hope you keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you all so much for being here in East Texas. Joy to have you. It's good to be out in the woods with some of you yesterday, too. Thank you for that. Okay. And I'm here to draw attention to a new program that's just starting. It's called East Texas Natives. And I know Parks and Wildlife, with all your wonderful restoration work, TxDOT, landowners, all need native seed. South Texas has it. They've got programs now in West Texas and Central Texas. And the Cesar Clayburgh Institute out of Texas A&M Kingsville is coming to East Texas. And I just want, as a point of information really for you, I know that you all need seed. I think all the landowners here do. And we have a great opportunity. I want to thank Senator Nichols for his support for this program, and thank all of you for listening and for being here, especially. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your hospitality. Is there anyone that wants to speak that I've missed or would care to speak? All right. Carter, do you want to say anything, or does anybody else want to say anything?
I grew up down in Port Arthur, so I consider this part of East Texas about as much of my home. I spent about 25 or 30 years working all up through here and everything, and I was amazed how fast it was growing, but I will tell you, the people are still the same, and we appreciate y'all's hospitality.
I have a question. Of the gentleman that spoke on the black bear, was that Adrian Van Dedler?
Van
Dellen. I think I know the answer to this question, but you can confirm it. Is the sighting of the males only a reflection of the males basically being put out of the habitat where there are females because the other male is the dominant and runs the others off?
Yes, a good question. The exact answer to that is really not known. We know they're coming in probably from Oklahoma, Arkansas, perhaps Louisiana, and they're young males. So they're probably being driven out of their particular range looking for females. And they get to East Texas, and they don't find any girls. So they go right back, we presume, but that's not known. We're hopeful that a program could be started where maybe some of those wandering bears could be collared, and we'd get more data on them, and the particular migration would be become better known to us. But we know they're coming in from surrounding states where bear have been restored in an active phase, an active program, very successful. Oklahoma this year has a second day of a bear hunt, only one day per day, 2 days. But we hope one day we can get that here. But they're not likely to stay, is what it amounts to.
Okay.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
All right, anyone else? Well, then I declare this commission has completed its business, and we are adjourned. And again, thank you for your hospitality, and it's been wonderful to be here today.